Good evening, everyone, or good afternoon, I guess it still is. I'll call the meeting of the Supplemental Finance Conference Committee to order. Our schedule this evening is we're going to finish the side-by-sides. We've got state government, we've got public safety, and then there was an article on transportation that the Senate had in their bill that, and I guess since it was in the bill, we're going to review it too, even though I really think it's going to be something that's maybe more for the transportation bill. And then I'm anticipating that we will take an hour break for dinner, and we will come back and take testimony that has been lined up on a number of areas, Department of Human Services, Corrections, and I think the Office of Higher Education. So before we get started, does anyone have any questions for me? All right, I know we've got Mr. Shepherd on the House side, and I guess I don't know who we have on the Senate side coming forward. All right.
I know this.
Well, Ms. James, Mr. Shepherd, welcome to the Supplemental Finance Conference Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first provisions we're going to go over are on the House side, so I will start with those. I'm Mark Shepherd from the House Research Department, and Ms. James and I are working straight from the side-by-side that should be in your binders, the state government side-by-side, and we'll start. The Chair's asked us to start with a comparison of the statutory provisions, so we'll start on page R11.
And committee members, I should say, I think this is the second to the last tab in your big book, so it's almost to the very back. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, on the House side, the first group of sections 1 to 7 on page R11 to R13, are all derived from a bill that Representative Knobloch and Senator Cohn co-authored relating to the work of the Legislative Advisory Commission on review of federal funds. And the highlights of these sections are they provide in section 1 that this LAC review will apply to all money, all federal money, regardless of whether it's appropriated in the general appropriation in chapter 4 or another section, that the review applies when the money is awarded. And then it goes on to specify some of the procedures for LAC review when money comes in during the interim between legislative sessions, and it defines what is an urgency. Mr. Chair, that brings us over to page R13. The next group of sections from R13 to R15 on the House side have to do with a new role for the legislative auditor in fiscal notes and revenue estimates. And these provisions provide that the legislative auditor would take over from MMB the administrative duties here. The legislative auditor would ask, when a request for a fiscal note comes in, the auditor would ask agencies to do the work. The work would come back to the auditor. The auditor would evaluate it, and there are procedures in this bill where the auditor could then submit the note as prepared by the agency, or could submit the auditor's own note with the possibility for submitting the agencies as well. That continues on to the bottom of page R15, where there are three sections that relate to the funding of the state auditor's county audit function. Under the current law, this function is paid for through an enterprise fund, and these House sections would instead provide that the function would be paid for from the state general fund. As the fiscal staff explained the other day, there's not a change of an effect. There's no net effect on the general fund here. It's just changing the accounting of where the money comes from. The next group of sections, Mr. Chair, beginning on R17, relate to the Department of Management and Budget. There are actually on page R16, there is a new requirement that MMB report, keep a centralized tracking list of new agency projects defined as projects in which a new amount of $100,000 or more would be spent. There's a new requirement that when the Commissioner of Management and Budget does the revenue forecast, that the Commissioner would report to the legislature within 14 days on uncertainty in the general fund revenue projections. And at the bottom of R17, there's a requirement for a report on federal funds providing a variety of information that's specified on R17 and R18 on federal funds. Section 17 on the House side on R18 relates to fees charged by state agencies, and this would state that a state agency can't propose a fee increase of more than 10% in a biennium. The next section, Mr. Chair, was in a bill that you carried that has to do with the budget reserve, setting the amount in the budget reserve. That's on page R19, line 2.36 on the House bill, and it sets the budget reserve at $1.596 billion. That carries down to the bottom of page R19 and R20, where there's a new requirement on the House side to disclose information about the potential for or the actual imposition of federal penalties on the state relating to if the state is purchasing its own bonds, as happened and reported by the legislative auditor earlier this year.
Mr. Chair, Stephanie James, Senate Counsel. On the Senate side, beginning on page R20 and going on to page R21, are sections 12 and 13 that relate to the Designer Selection Board. These sections raise the threshold amount of a contract before the Designer Selection Board has to be involved in selecting a designer for a project. And section 13 adds geographic proximity of the designer to the project to the list of things that the Designer Selection Board considers when selecting a designer.
Mr. Chair, that brings us up to page R22 on the House side. There's a current law requirements for the next group of sections in the House bill relate to the Department of Administration. There's a requirement in current law for reporting on construction and major remodeling. This section imposes some new requirements when a project has changed or has increased in cost. On page R23, there's a requirement that if there's ever a new requirement for legislative approval of construction of a building, that would have to be fulfilled by approval of the full legislature, not by one or more committees of the legislature. The next two sections on R23 on the House side relate to state grants. The first one provides that every grant agreement must state that the agreement will be immediately terminated if the recipient is convicted of a crime relating to state grant agreements. And the next one provides that a state agency can't charge the recipient of a grant that is made from the general fund a fee and can't deduct money from the grant to pay administrative expenses. On the bottom of 23, under current law, the Commissioner of Administration can delegate duties to other agencies and individuals. This requires the Commissioner to develop guidelines for those agencies and for the Commissioner to audit these delegations at least once every 3 years. The bottom of R23 and the top of R24, there's a requirement in federal law that certain companies report to the Securities and Exchange Commission on information relating to conflict minerals that originated in the Republic of the Congo or neighboring countries. This provision would forbid the state from purchasing goods or services knowingly from a group that had failed to meet its obligations under the federal law. On page 25 is a provision that says whenever practical, a public entity should purchase printer or duplication cartridges that have 10% post-consumer material or are remanufactured or are backed by a vendor program that will take back the printer cartridges when they are done. The next House provision on R25, section 26, deals with targeted groups for purposes of state purchasing and provides that an individual business must be included as a targeted group if the business agrees as a condition of the contract that its workforce will be composed of at least 40% minority persons or veterans.
Mr. Chair and members, the next provision on page R25 on the Senate side, section 3 and going through section 8, on page R29 are a proposal from the Department of Administration to make some changes to the preference programs. This harmonizes the preference programs for the small businesses, the small targeted group businesses, the veteran-owned small businesses, and the small businesses in economically disadvantaged areas. And Section 7 also is a new provision that gives the Commissioner of Administration the ability to designate contracts to a combination of those groups. And Section 8 is partly a harmonizing provision to treat all of the groups the same, and then also removes an unused provision relating to procurement from rehabilitation facilities and extended employment providers. Then on page R29 is a provision from Article 8. From the Senate side, Section 14 there is a new preference program, and this applies to targeted groups and to veteran-owned businesses that are not small. And the preference is up to 3%. This also includes a requirement that the commissioner will prepare recommendations for establishing a mentoring program for targeted groups and veteran groups. The next provision, Section 15, it also relates to that new preference program, and it permits a private entity to be used for certification for eligibility for the preference programs and requires the Commissioner of Administration to conduct rulemaking by expedited procedures for implementing this new preference program.
Mr. Chair, the next provisions on the House and the Senate side are identical, and they relate to an account in the Office of Minut, the state's IT agency. It provides that unexpended operating balances that are appropriated by a state agency can be transferred to this information and technology systems account for Minut and can be used for specific projects administered by Minut. The bill then establishes a process for LAC Legislative Advisory Commission review of the amounts transferred to this account. And that carries over all the way over to page R32, where it requires reporting on the use of this new authority. Then we have some House-only provisions on page R32. The House provision limits the number of FTEs in executive agencies and specifies means of achieving compliance with this requirement. The next, there's a large group of sections on the House side. It goes from R33 all the way to R49 that relate to the Board of Barber Examiners. There's a comparable bill in the Senate that last I checked is awaiting floor action in the Senate. I believe Senator Wicklund had the bill. And this bill makes a variety of changes that the agency characterized as technical, administrative, and modernizing things. The one substantive provision the agency pointed out is that they are doing away with the concept of apprentices in barber law, and so people in barber schools will complete all of their practical training in the barber college itself instead of going through a formal apprenticeship with a barber. And there are a variety of requirements in here which I am not going to go through tonight, but I can answer questions about them. We have summaries if you'd like. Mr. Chair, that carries all the way over to page R49 on the House side, where there's a provision about the Veterans Preference Act in removal from public employment. There are several new substantive parts of this section. It first of all provides that this section applies only when the person has completed any probationary period that exists within a municipality. It provides that the veteran must request a hearing within 30 days instead of 60 days. It gives the veteran an alternative to have an arbitrator decide the hearing instead of decide the case rather than a three-person panel. And it specifies circumstances under which the public employer would have to pay the costs of the hearing. And that carries over all the way to page R51.
Mr. Chair and members, on the Senate side, Section 21 and Section 22 relate to the personal needs allowance that veterans receive who are in reside in veterans' homes. This increases the amount both in 2017 and 2018 and then sets an automatic increase as a percentage of the CPI, and provides that when a veteran is in arrears on their residency payments, that that will not reduce their personal needs allowance. The next provision on page R52 on the Senate side is Section 23, and this paves the way for veterans' homes in Montevideo and Bemidji by allowing the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to apply for federal funds, and then also allows the Commissioner of Administration to accept contributions towards those facilities.
And the next provision on R52, Mr. Chair, is a House-only provision. It relates to the IRRRB. It strikes from the current law some exemptions that the IRRRB has from laws that govern state contracting and from laws that govern MINUT, the state technology agency. That continues on to the bottom of R53, where the House and the Senate have provisions that are substantially identical relating to peace officers killed in the line of duty. This adopts largely a definition from a federal law, makes the state law similar to the federal law for those people who are killed in the line of duty. On page R54, the House has provisions. These are similar to provisions that I believe have passed the Senate now in a bill sponsored by Senator Wicklund, Senate File 2930, relating to Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. On page R54, the monthly fee that the owner of the park is allowed to charge is increased from $12 to $15 a year, or $1 to $125 a month. And then on that continues on to R55, the same change. And then on R56, the maximum reimbursement that can be paid for relocation, the payments by the park owner are increased from $4,000 to $7,000 for a single section, from $8,000 to $12,500 for a multi-section manufactured home. Some of the other, some of the same changes continue on page R57 and R58. Page R58 on the House and the Senate have identical provisions again relating to peace officers killed in the line of duty. This changes the law governing the Public Employees Retirement Association to provide that their line of duty death would be aligned with the determinations made by the Commissioner of Public Safety that under the definition we spoke about earlier. The next provision is has to do with municipal ordinances. This actually passed the House earlier today. Same language provides that it has to do with interim ordinances that affect housing, and it requires 10-day notice. That moves over to page R60 and following. There are some changes that affect the program known as HIDA, School District Insurance Coverage. Among the changes here, it eliminates the requirement that districts get a request from PEEP. It extends the maximum length of the contracts up to 5 years, up to 4 years for health insurance negotiated in connection with a service cooperative. And it strikes a provision that says school districts will not be considered self-insured solely by participation in a joint powers agreement, and provides that the exclusive representative of the largest group of employees must not exercise under the authority that they have under existing law to remove the employer from PEEP. That brings us over to page R62 also. At the bottom of the page, this relates, it was part of the HIDA law when that was enacted, and this amends the local government gift law to make the definition of local official include an elected board member of a service cooperative and an elected or appointed board member of a exclusive representative of a Minnesota public employee.
That brings us to page R63. On the Senate side is an amendment to the 2015 appropriation to the governor's office. This change will permit the governor's office to charge agencies for office costs. This money is deposited into a special revenue account and then is appropriated to the governor. On page R64, at the top of the page, section 25, is a provision that allocates the space that is currently 5,000 square feet of the space that the Senate currently has in the state office building. It transfers that to the revisor of statutes. It also directs the Commissioner of Administration to cancel the lease at 525 Park for the revisor's office. And then the money that is saved by canceling the lease in fiscal years 2016 and 2017 is appropriated to the Commissioner of Administration to remodel the state office building for the revisor's office. The next provision on page R64, section 26, is a study that the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs would perform to quantify and describe the unmet needs among Minnesota veterans for behavioral and mental health services with a report to the legislature. Section 27, beginning at the very bottom of page R64 and going on to R65, is another study. The Commissioner of Veterans Affairs is directed to study the feasibility of partnering with an established nonprofit organization to provide interim housing for disabled veterans in conjunction with services. On page R65, section 28 is a plaque or marker that is authorized to be placed in the Capitol building to honor the efforts and sacrifice of workers who constructed the state Capitol building, as well as those who worked on subsequent projects to preserve the building. And section 29 on page R65 establishes an immigration integration advisory task force to research state laws and rules that negatively affect immigrants.
Mr. Chair, the next provision is a House provision on R66. It continues all the way over to R68, where the actual change is. This is just a correction of a mistaken cross-reference from the 2015 bill. I believe the identical provision has passed the Senate in the revisor's correction bill. At the bottom of R68, the House requires the Commissioner of Management and Budget to audit state employee out-of-state travel expenses. At the top of R69, the House section requires the state auditor to report to the legislature with a strategic plan to ensure that all local governments receive adequate oversight from the office of the state auditor. The next House section, section 72 on R69, provides that the debt service on the design and construction allocated to the parking garage adjacent located by the Minnesota Senate building must be paid for by fees charged to persons parking in that parking garage. No fees may be charged to members of the public parking in spaces designated for persons with a disability parking certificate. Section 73 on the House side requires the state auditor to report to the legislature on costs incurred by Minnesota counties relating to eligibility determinations and related enrollment activities due to implementing the system administered by MNSHR. The next House section, R69, and continuing on to R70 and 71, creates a legislative surrogacy commission to develop recommendations on policies and laws regarding surrogacy. That brings us over to R71. Section 75 on the House side requires the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy to make recommendations to the legislature on the process and timing for establishment of joint budget targets. Section 76 and 77 are part of the Barber Board legislation. The repealers in Section 78, the first one repeals the State Auditor Enterprise Fund, the next one repeals the Legislative Water Commission, and the final ones repeal things related to the Barber Board. Mr. Chair, that concludes our walkthrough.
Any questions for Mr. Shepherd or Ms. James? Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, let me just... Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. Let me go back. I meant to ask this and unfortunately let you... I didn't skip over it, but didn't ask in time. Mr. Shepherd, going back to R63, an elected or appointed member of a board of a local or statewide organization that is an exclusive representative of a Minnesota public employee. And maybe you're not in a position to answer this, but so I understand what the concern is. But can we do something that I think involves a private employee? Because obviously, if we have somebody who is the executive director of AFSCME or interfaculty at MinSCU, certainly those are public employee groups. But isn't the director a private person then? And are we able then to have this kind of impact on that person?
Senator Cohen, I guess I don't know that I know enough about this particular section to answer that question. I know I had talked to Representative Anderson, the author of the state government finance bill, and she couldn't be here this evening. I don't know, Mr. Shepherd, if you've got any knowledge on this that you could give us?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, I think Senator Cohen has correctly interpreted how the provision would work, but it's probably best for one of the members to explain the rationale for it.
Senator Cohen.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shepherd, I'm not asking for kind of an off-the-cuff opinion, so I'll just pose the question that do we have a statutory ability or authority where we can place this kind of imposition, whether right or wrong, on somebody who essentially is in private employment? I mean, for instance, could we tell the, we wouldn't tell the CEO of pick a company that they could, that they'd be prohibited from accepting a gift from somebody. And is that person more analogous to the head of a public employees union, or is the public employees union, because of the folks they have jurisdiction over, more analogous to the public official? So I'm honestly looking for some kind of exposition on that, but I just ask the question to maybe take a look at it. Maybe it's with Representative Anderson at some other time.
You know, I guess I would, in a very big picture way, Senator Cohen, I guess I would say that, you know, we do have wage and hour laws, and I think about at the federal level, there are, you know, not that this is, I don't want to in any way compare this to what I'm about to say, but, you know, there are regulations on businesses and the ethical conduct they can have when they're trying to get business contracts and not paying bribes and things like that. So I'm not comparing that to this, except to say that we do have laws that we sometimes pass that affect private organizations and their conduct. But I guess in terms of the more detailed rationale behind this particular language, I think I'd have to ask Chair Anderson. Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on page R63, 191.12 through 191.19, Senate-only language dealing with funding for the executive office. With transfers from other areas, and just if somebody could just explain what that is.
Mr. Lundeen, welcome back to the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'm Kevin Lundeen, Senate Fiscal Analyst. This particular language is some language that we previously, a couple of years ago, had in the rider language for the governor's office. And what the governor's office has been doing for a number of administrations is they're paying for some of the staffing and their federal office through transfers coming from state agencies. And so what this essentially does is sets up a special revenue account that these dollars that are transferred from agencies can be deposited into. And it came about, I should add, the legislative auditor did a financial audit on the office of the governor. And this was one of the recommendations. They asked the governor's office to get some further clarification from the legislature in law about how setting up this fund and depositing money into this particular account.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lundeen. And was this specifically dedicated towards the legislative auditor's report reflected around expenditures with the residents, with the federal office in Washington, both, or was there structure around it? Because I can't really tell by reading it.
Mr. Lundeen.
Yeah, that is correct.
What is correct?
That it was structured around the federal office, staffing in the governor's office, some of the policy advisors, and so forth. And I think some of it, I don't think any of it goes towards the governor's residence itself, if I'm remembering correctly.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Lindy, maybe I missed the first part of your answer, but is there a... Are these payments structured on a particular, like, percentage basis, or how are these payments determined?
Mr. Chair, the governor's office and the state agencies they draw up some agreements, and the agencies how much they're going to pay over time. I'm not sure exactly how for each agency it's determined, but I mean, generally, some of the larger agencies are contributing more than the smaller agencies.
I mean, so can the governor, I guess I don't know exactly what's in 15.53. I mean, can the governor just say, well, we need more money this year, you've got to give us another $200,000?
Mr. Chair, there is not a limit on the amount, you know, that can be transferred over. I mean, in previous years, there was a limit that we had put in the law on how much, I think that was during the Pawlenty administration, how much money could be transferred over. But there has been nothing in there in recent years limiting the amount.
Okay. Any other questions on this subject? Otherwise, as long as I've got you up there, Mr. Lundeen, maybe I can go back to page R20 and the increase in the limit on fees and size of projects with the designer selection board. And I guess my question on that just is, so as I understand it right now, if you've got a building project that's over $2 million, you've got to go through the designer selection board. If it's under $2 million, you can basically hire your own architect and basically use your own architect from, let's say, your own city or whatever to do it. And this would raise it to $10 million, and so we would be having a much larger number of agencies, MNSCU, colleges, institutions, presumably using someone locally and choosing their own architect as opposed to going through the designer selection board. Is that correct?
I think I'm going to defer to Ms. James. She worked more on this language than myself.
Sure, Ms. James.
Mr. Chair and members, this proposal came forward from Senator Tomasoni, and yes, that was his intention was that more local architects would be able to be employed in projects by raising this threshold.
And in the hiring of the local architects, I guess what laws would still be enforced? I mean, are you required to get bids from a certain number of local architects? I mean, can you just pick your favorite local architect? How would that work?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about that. I would need to look into it. I'm not sure.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on that section? Any other questions on the state government finance section in total that we've just gone through from members? All right. Well, Ms. James, Mr. Shepherd, Mr. Lundeen, thank you very much. We'll move on to the public safety section. Okay. And Ms. Pirius, Mr. Backus, welcome to the Supplemental Finance Committee. Are we going through the side-by-sides in the regular bill?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Please begin.
Mr. Chair and members, for the committee, Rebecca Pirius, House Research. I will be starting with the statutory provisions, and they start on page R9. Since most of the provisions are House provisions, I'm just going to go through the entire side-by-side, and if there are questions on Senate provisions, I'll defer to my counterpart, Mr. Backus.
All right.
Mr. Chair and members, starting on page R9, Section 1 is a House-only provision. This provision increases the minimum fine from $300 to $500 for failure to stop for a school bus displaying a stop sign, stop arm, or illegally passing on the right of a school bus flashing amber lights. Moving down to Section 2.
Ms. Pierce, do you know, is this Representative Erdahl's provision? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe this is, but it is a engrossed version. Certain parts were taken out of the original bill.
All right, thank you. Please proceed.
Section 2 is on R9, but the applicable provisions are at the bottom of R10 and R11. This is increasing penalties for certain offenses related to driving without a valid driver's license. Currently, they're misdemeanors. This is going to make it a gross misdemeanor if the person causes a collision resulting in substantial bodily harm or a person's death. It will also make it a gross misdemeanor for a third or subsequent violation for driving without a valid license in a 10-year period. And then finally, on page R11, it will set minimum fines, $750 for a second conviction and $1,500 for a third or subsequent violation. Moving on, Section 3.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Pierce, just curious, it wouldn't be a lot of money, but was there a fiscal note with this? And was there anything, I don't recall seeing anything in the spreadsheet, but...
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there would be because this would be at the local jail level. These would not be people going to prison.
No, I'm just wondering, in the case of the fines, if that was being brought into the court system, if there was any... Okay. It's probably pretty minimal, but, you know, we're looking for money.
Pardon? Mr. Walls, do you have anything to say on this? Do you want to come forward? Mr. Walls, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, there was a fiscal note prepared on this bill. There was some revenue that was noted in, or potential revenue that was noted in the bill, but because traffic violations have different rules to where the money goes, depending on which jurisdiction it's prosecuted in and so forth, the revenue that was estimated to be in this bill was small and undetermined as to who would receive it.
Okay, thanks. That was my guess, but just curious.
All right. Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair and members, we're moving on to the bottom of R11. These are identical House and Senate provisions. It's Section 1 on the Senate side, Section 3 on the House side. The actual change in the statute is on line 1.22 on the Senate side and 210.16 on the House side. This is amending the predatory offender registration statute. Striking the language is actually going to expand the registration in prostitution offenses. It will include not only cases or require registration where the offense involved a minor under 13, but also undercover operations. And this change is related to changes we will also see in Section 6 later on. Mr. Chair, I'm moving on to the bottom of page R13, section 4 on the House side, and this is a House-only provision. This is allowing sensory testing services to possess and serve alcohol as part of their business operations, and these firms will be licensed by DPS. Next on page R14, section 5 is listed as a House-only provision. This is felony assault motivated by bias. It's increasing the statutory maximum penalty by 25% for felony assault motivated by bias. There is actually a similar Senate language that just passed off the floor a couple days ago, but I do want to make one note that in the original versions for the House and Senate, the term religion was inadvertently left out of the protected classes. That has been fixed in the Senate, but it hasn't been fixed in this version. Moving on to the bottom of page R14, section 2 on the Senate side, section 6 on the House side. These are identical House and Senate provisions. This is amending the crime of hiring a minor to engage in prostitution. This law was amended last year to provide penalties in undercover operations, but it was limited to a 5-year felony for any age. This section is now going to create tiered penalties based on the age of the minor. So it will be 5 years if the minor was believed to be 16 or 17, 10 years if the minor was believed to be 13, 14, or 15, and 20 years if under 13. And these penalties are in line with the current structure of the law. Moving on to the bottom of page R15. This is a Senate-only provision, Section 8. It is requiring the POST Board, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, to create a list of approved training courses to instruct officers in techniques for responding to mental health crises. And it will require peace officers holding an active license to get 4 hours of continuing ed every 3 years. Moving on to R16, there is a House-only provision. The language is actually on R17. This is amending a 2015 rider language. It will extend the authorization to use disaster contingency account monies for avian influenza emergency response. And then the revised language would also permit monies in the account to be used for any agricultural emergency. And it's going to make the money available through fiscal year 2019. Moving on to Section 9, this is a House-only provision directing the Commissioner of Corrections to attempt to enter into a contract to operate and purchase or lease to own a private prison in Appleton. And finally, Section 10 is a House-only provision transferring $1 million from MnCorp to the general fund. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the public safety and corrections side by side.
Thank you, Ms. Pirius. Mr. Backus, any questions on the public safety section? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. Okay, next we have the transportation section, which is a Senate exclusive section. It's, I guess, not part of the revisers section here, but it has been passed out as a separate item this way. So members, I'd call your attention to that we're going to be going through the Senate transportation provisions like this. And again, members, I guess, you know, I'm kind of expecting this is something that really the Transportation Committee will be dealing with, but since it was part of the Senate Supplemental Finance Bill and we're doing the side-by-sides and it was there, I think that we need to go through it. And Ms. Brzozowski, welcome to the Supplemental Finance Conference Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bonnie Brzozowski, Senate Counsel. And I will be walking through Article 11. Article 10 is the fiscal, is the appropriations, and Ms. Boyd already reviewed the spreadsheet with you for Article 10. So I'll be focusing on Article 11.
Where does that start? Do you have a page?
Page
209.
Okay. Section 1 of Article 11 is the first of a number of sections that occur throughout the article that have to do with railroads and their responsibilities in preparing and for and responding to oil and hazardous substance discharge from oil trains. Section 1 amends existing law, and it has to do with preparedness and response on the part of the railroads. It adds to already existing requirements that railroads offer training to responders along oil train routes. It adds emergency managers as part of the training, and also requires railroads to coordinate with various entities to assess local threats in high population areas. There are specifics that are required of railroads in conducting environmental response drills, and there are requirements having to do with the railroad's prevention and response plan. It specifies additional contents for those plans and also frequency of required updates. And the railroads, finally, in Section 1, are also required to file with MnDOT a financial responsibility plan that shows that the railroad company has the ability to pay for environmental costs of derailments and discharge of hazardous substances and oil. Section 2 is on a different topic, and that allows the Commissioner of Transportation, specifically having to do with highway construction on the Red Lake Reservation, to allow a preference of up to 10% for Indian-owned contractors, or the Commissioner can allow a tribal authority to award and administer a highway construction contract on the Red Lake Reservation. Section 3 has to do with the currently required trunk highway bridge inspection report that MnDOT creates and submits, and the change in this section would require the report every 2 years instead of every year. Section 4 requires the Department of Public Safety to cancel a vehicle registration and refund the payment of registration taxes if the owner applies for a refund of taxes within the first 10 days of the registration period. And Section 5 is part of a series of sections that comprise 5, 6, 7, and 11 and 13. And these add references to motorized bicycles, to the types of vehicles that may bear a disability plate if the eligibility conditions are met, and the owner of the motorized bicycle can obtain the plates or the certificate and secure the certificate to the vehicle, and then avail himself or herself of disability parking privileges. Section 8 creates a new special license plate, and this is for law enforcement memorial license plates. And applicants must make annual contributions to the Minnesota Law Enforcement Memorial Association. Section 9 is an initiative that also includes sections 29 and 30, and this creates a transfer on death title to motor vehicles. An owner of a motor vehicle can designate a TOD beneficiary, and that designation takes effect on the transferor's death. The transfer is exempt from motor vehicle sales tax, and it's also subject to claims by the Department of Human Services or the counties for Medicaid payment reimbursement, and also the Department of Revenue for unpaid income taxes. Section 10 and Section 14 are part of the same initiative, and this extends the sunset on the collection by the Department of Public Safety of a $1 surcharge on all title and registration and driver's license transactions. And this $1 surcharge goes into a technology account.
Excuse me, Ms. Berzovsky, you just referenced Section 10. What page are you on? I'm wondering if we've got the same engrossment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wondered about that too because my page numbers are different from yours. So I have the unofficial engrossment 2749-1.
Senator Laurie.
Yeah, if there was a section that wasn't in here, one that was added, then that's why we have the first engrossment.
Right.
Thank you.
Maybe you can. Do you have? You've got our engrossment there now, I assume.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Someone just handed it to me. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm trying to think. I think you just started to talk about our Section 10 on page 218. The pavement life cycle costs. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that would be the next section. And
why don't you take it from there then? Because I think you had covered all the other sections earlier than this.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering about, there is one.
Unless you think I missed something, and that's fine, I could have.
I think there might be one section that was missed here, and that is. Well, I don't know why it does not appear to be in this engrossment. Oh, no, it is. I'm sorry. Section 8. Section 8 adds to the definition of physically disabled person a condition of dementia with associated physical complications as a qualifying condition to obtain disability plates.
Okay, so just a minute, as long as we're on this. So this would be disability plates for what sort of motorized vehicle?
Mr. Chair, this applies to passenger vehicles, to one-ton pickups, to motorcycles and motorized bicycles under the new language.
So we would now say that a person could get a disability plate if they had been diagnosed with dementia and would be able to then drive a vehicle.
Mr. Chair, someone else could drive the vehicle. It doesn't go along with driving privileges. It's just parking privileges. So a person could obtain, if a person with dementia owns a vehicle or is transported in another person's vehicle on a regular basis, they can get the plates or the hanging placard.
For the handicapped parking.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I see. Okay. All right. Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 10 relates to a report that's required of MnDOT, and that is a pavement life cycle cost analysis. And this makes some amendments to the content of the analysis that's done to compare paving materials and also specifies with more detail when the report is due. The next section and series of sections has to do with special transportation services. And this initiative has to do with some legislation that was enacted last year, a series of sections that subject special transportation service providers to vehicle standards and background check requirements. The main thrust of these changes in this year's bill have to do with giving MnDOT and Human Services Enforcement Authority to enforce these standards. So, for example, MnDOT has the duty to inspect special transportation service vehicles. It can pull vehicles out of service. It can revoke a certificate of compliance That type of enforcement authority is contained in these next several sections. Okay. And that takes us, I believe, to section 17. And that is another rail initiative. And this section expands the existing state rail safety inspection program. The current program allows the Commissioner of Transportation to hire 3 or 4 state rail safety inspectors. And this language would allow the Commissioner to employ up to 9 rail safety inspectors. It modifies the existing assessment on rail carriers, but not as to amount, just as to division among the rail carriers who pay for this program. And it requires MnDOT to maintain on its public website information on the state rail safety inspection program so that the public would be able to see the results of the inspections, including defect track defects, violations, inspection reports, enforcement, and so on, as well as the cost of the program. Section 18 amends statutory language that creates the grade crossing safety account, and that refers to rail grade crossings. And this just clarifies the sources and the uses of the funds, of the money that is in that account. Section 19 is an additional section relating to rail safety, and this is a new section of statute. It has to do with incident emergency response preparation and information. And this section requires the railroad carriers to notify various local entities and also the Department of Public Safety that operate along oil train routes as to the location of their of the railroad's emergency response equipment and where the personnel happen to be at a given time in case they're needed to respond to an emergency or to an incident. The rail carriers are required to provide route planning and analysis and risk assessment to the local emergency managers and fire chiefs along the route. And they are required to provide emergency response plans and also railroad bridge inspection reports to the local emergency authorities. Subdivision 6 requires all the rail carriers to maintain a single software program that could be accessible by either by an app or over the internet. And this program has to be available to provide specific information on transportation of oil and other hazardous substances.
Yeah, Ms. Berzovsky, I don't know that we need quite that much detail as we go through each of the sections, particularly since this is a transportation area that we're probably not going to be doing work on.
Sure. Okay, then I will move along to the sections 20, 21, and 22 that modify the terms of the rail service improvement account, having to do with the appropriate uses of money in that fund. Then the next section 23 has to do with the special transportation service program, which I've covered already. Section 25 has to do with the TOD title, and that's been covered already. Sections 26 and 27 were covered in state government. There is some crossover there and duplication between this article and the state government side by side, and this has to do with killed in the line of duty. Section 28 is, Section 28 is another railroad section having to do with incident preparedness, and this just amends existing law to provide for some additional uses of funds, and it increases in a statutory appropriation to the PCA for their environmental protection activities relating to railroad discharge preparedness. Section 30 is line of duty death, and this is also in the state government side by side. Sections 31 and the next several sections have to do with drones. And the Section 31 defines drones. Section 32 adds to the list of aviation-related misdemeanors to a couple of drone-related misdemeanors, and those are at 243.6 and following. There is a drone commercial use permit that's established in Section 35, and this applies to drones that weigh less than 55 pounds and are used for a commercial purpose. The owner has to obtain a permit from MnDOT and list all of the qualified operators. The operators have to be at least 17 years of age, and they have to take a knowledge test. Section 36 is an amendment to 1994 laws, just removing a restriction on a land conveyance from MnDOT to the city of Floodwood. Sections 37 to 41 push an effective date out 2 years, and this relates to legislation that was chief authored in the Senate by Senator Saxhog, having to do with expiration of freight overweight permits expiring at the same time as the vehicle registration, and it's being pushed out because of the new computer system coming to Department of Public Safety. Section 42 requires a report on the new registration system at Public Safety. And Section 43 is a response to a legislative auditor report that had some critiques of MnDOT's project selection process. And this requires MnDOT to adopt best practices and a more transparent and objective process in selecting highway projects. Section 44 establishes an autonomous vehicles task force. And the duty of the task force is to design but not conduct a pilot project that would utilize autonomous or self-driving vehicles in providing for the mobility needs of people with disabilities. Section 45 is a transitway development outreach pilot grant program. And this would provide, through the City of St. Paul, a competitive grant program to outreach to, in particular, minority communities and new American communities on development and use of transitways. And Section 46 is a recodification instruction to the reviser.
All right, bearing in mind that this is, again, a transportation article that I'm guessing we are really not going to be having that much to do with. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Berezovsky? All right, thank you, Ms. Berezovsky. And members, I believe we have completed all of the side-by-sides, unless someone is aware of something that we've missed. Anyone aware of anything we've missed?
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Dean.
Would it be possible to go through the side-by-side from yesterday again?
Backwards.
Only the human service section.
Only the human service section. Oh, okay. All right. Well, unless anyone has any other questions, I guess it's my intention that we will recess until 7:30, so we've got time for dinner. And then we'll come back and do the testimony that I had previously talked about. Any questions before I recess? All right, we're in recess till 7:30. Good evening, everyone. Sorry, dinner ran a little bit late. But anyway, thanks for your patience. In terms of trying to make sure that we've got the minimum number of people staying longer than they have to, I'm going to ask Mr. Pogamiller to come forward so we can, I think it's the only testimony we've got tonight on the Office of Higher Education or on the Higher Education section. So I thought we could start with Commissioner Pogamiller, Senator Pogamiller, former Majority Leader Pogomiller, a man of many titles. Welcome to the Supplemental Finance Committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want Senator Cohen to know I got his note last night.
And good work. But Mr. Chairman, now you're in the House, it doesn't make as much of a difference.
Were you ever in the House?
I was for 2 years.
Oh, well, all right. Welcome back. Well, members, I know I've got a few questions for Commissioner Pogomiller on the higher ed article and some spreadsheets, but I guess I also want to avail the opportunity for anyone else who wants to ask questions too. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could we ask the Commissioner maybe just to indicate a little bit about what's being presented in this conference committee? Obviously, we have it in the Senate bill, but ask for a little bit of explanation and then open up the question.
Well, I think,
okay.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Sure. Commissioner, can you give us kind of your opening statement on the higher education area, at least as far as it relates to the Office of Higher Education?
Mr. Chairman, I will. There's a handout that works off, and I was told you mostly wanted to talk about the equity and attainment issues. And this works off what the governor's original recommendation was. It was $20 million. The Senate ended up with $14 million, but slightly structured slightly differently than the governor. And just to go back to what the governor's thinking was, he had money to support MNSCU's general budget of $21 million in his budget, and then he had an equity package of $20 million. And I think he viewed those as working together. Tough to get help MNSCU alter the course of events on inequities in graduation rates and attainment rates if they're cutting back budgets relative to their lower enrollments. So that was the governor's thinking. The Senate then kind of followed that a little bit, and so the Senate has roughly, $10 million for operating, which is relative to the governor's $21 million. And the Senate then has $14 million for equity relative to the governor's 20. So they basically, the Senate cut both of those back slightly. But I think the general frame is about the same in terms of supporting MNSCU organizations where the major challenge is with regards to attainment. It exists in the non-public colleges and at the U of M also. But the biggest challenge, because of the number of students, is at the MNSCU campuses. And the gaps are pretty significant, and in some areas the gaps are actually growing. And in the governor's thinking, he's thinking along, he's mostly thinking about the gaps based on race. Others like to think in terms of income and race, but I think the way the governor framed up his package was mostly around race. There's obviously a correlation. So the idea was for these equity grants was to support institutional change within MNSCU, by and large MNSCU, to create a culture that will get the kind of results, cultures on campuses that will get the kind of results for first generation students and students of color that we're getting for majority students in terms of retention and completion. And on this sheet, we know from research, the third page of this, this is what the governor had in mind, that the grants would be supportive of things like proactive advising, summer bridge programs, restructuring of developmental ed. Those are just three of the research-based things that we know work, have worked around the country, where people have closed these gaps. And the governor's thinking was is that if we make some investment there, we should be able to close those gaps in Minnesota. So that's the basic structure. And obviously the governor also had some money in for the University of Minnesota around the health. I think some of your Human Service Committee knows this, when the contract for, I'm having a mental block, Chairman, who was the contract that the university didn't get for health care that caused them to have a $10 million
gap? Oh, UCARE.
UCARE, thank you. It's funny, UCARE, I should have remembered that. So that the governor was trying to support that. He had money in for that, $10 to $12 million. The Senate has $5 million. In addition, the Senate has some money for tuition relief at the university. So I think the general approach, even though the funding isn't exactly what the governor wanted, He thinks the general approach by the Senate is fairly balanced, and he would like to see those kinds of investments. I should, even though this was not in the governor's proposal, the Senate basically takes that $14 million and cuts it in half. $7 million is pretty much directed to Minsku for the things I described on a grant basis. And another seven is for, Mr. Chairman, you asked this question yesterday, what are those organizations? And that would be for like TRIO, Wallen, potentially a private college that is doing some work in this area, College Possible, potentially. So those are the kind of programs that that other $7 million, in the Senate's view now, should be directed toward.
Okay.
I think that let me state the obvious, not to pick on the Senate, but the governor would be thrilled if you took that entire $14 million and gave it to his original proposal.
Well, so, Commissioner, let's focus in on, anyone else have any questions for Commissioner Pogemiller at the moment? Otherwise, Commissioner, let me start by talking about this whole equity article and the $14 million. So, I mean, I see the language and the grants. I mean, is it fair to say that these are grants to institutions? They aren't grants to students.
Mr. Chairman, yes. That's the way the governor had structured it, but the Senate basically splits it. $7 million to institutions, $7 million to basically nonprofits.
Right, okay. And, I mean, from the governor's point of view, let's focus in on the $7 million that was the governor's program. You know, why did he do it that way as opposed to just having some additional money for disadvantaged students?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think his thinking is that you need to create some systemic change within the institutions. And directing them to do research-based things with some accountability through a grant program is the approach he's decided to take. Keep in mind, he also had $21 million directly to Minsku to kind of help their base budget. So he was trying to be balanced. He thinks it takes both. But I think it's fair to say he maybe, as many legislators have over the years, is becoming frustrated that just general appropriations to our institutions don't always get the exact results that we're looking for.
Well, when I look at the language it's on page R43 in terms of the equity article, I mean, we've got $7 million of grants for, you know, I look at things like orientation to college life, financial aid, counseling, academic advising, mentoring. I mean, aren't a lot of those things already being done in every institution?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. All of these best practices are being done somewhere in Minnesota. What the governor's trying to accomplish is getting it scaled up to actually close the gaps. And so I think at a $7 million amount, you'd probably pick one or two campuses and try to close the gaps on those campuses.
But Commissioner, how do you close the gaps then? I guess, are you saying that right now individuals who are disadvantaged individuals and aren't doing as well as we had hoped, that they, I mean, every one of these campuses, I think, has got financial aid counseling, every one of them has got some sort of orientation to college life, every one of them has got academic counseling, it's basically saying that there's just not enough of it and that these students need it more intensively and they aren't getting their share?
Mr. Chairman, let's take an example of North Hennepin Community College. They are doing something, they are doing intrusive advisor or proactive advising, which is research-based. People know it works. That campus knows it works. They are not able to do it for all their students. And so the idea of the grant would be to say, if you think additional resources there would close your gaps, here's the grant with some rubrics on performance. So I think all of these best practices exist on Minnesota campuses. I think we're talking a scale issue and We want to get beyond piloting this stuff. We want to get to this is the way the institution operates. And so that hopefully we would wake up 5 or 10 years from now and say, okay, that is just fundamental to what they do on that campus. So it's not a question of whether they're not trying. I think everybody thinks they are, and there's a lot of good examples of things. But by campus, we have not closed the gaps. And around the country, there are campuses. There's an example in California of a community college with 30,000 students. Over a five-year period, they closed the gaps. And it's they have, I think it's 40% Latino, 30% African American. They just closed the gaps. And it was intensive. It was using best practices, and I think we just need to start doing that in Minnesota.
And Commissioner, I guess you're saying that we do have some campuses that are doing a good job in these areas.
They are, Mr. Chairman, they are doing some of these things or all of these things. They're just not doing it at the scale or fundamentally inculcated into the culture of the entire campus so that it works for all the students.
So do those campuses have better results than the campuses
yes.
that aren't doing it? Can you give us some examples of which campuses are being more, are the most successful campuses in this area?
I'll take North Hennepin, Mr. Chairman. I'll take North Hennepin again. They have shown with the cohort of students that they are applying this intensive advising to, they have shown great progress in terms of closing the gaps for those students. It's that they don't do it broad. They're not able to do it broadly enough. Now that, I think I buy their argument that they're not able to do it broadly enough. They need more resources. Others would argue otherwise. They'd say you have the resources. Get it done. I think the governor's approach is maybe a combination of two things there might work.
Senator Corn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, could I follow up on your question with the commissioner?
Absolutely.
If you're able, if we use North Hennepin as the model, are you able to provide some quantification? How many students currently at North Hennepin, or say in the last 5 years, or if you have some idea, have had difficulty with retention on the campus and going from year to year? And how many people who then participated in these programs have had success? What kind of success rate is there? And what's the uncovered need at North Hennepin, if you're able to offer some quantification?
Mr. Chairman, I can't, sitting here right now, I can't give you the exact numbers. We have those, absolutely willing to provide it. This is kind of the Cliff Notes version of that, but it does not have the exact numbers. But that we have that data from the campuses, and that's why we use these examples. They have a cohort at North Hennepin that they've identified that they can say we did make this difference with these students. That is available. I can get it to the committee.
Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, I just probably should indicate that I was and said to several people afterwards that when I had a chance to meet with people from the agency, I was very impressed with the presentation made in my office. But thought about that afterwards as to whether or not there's quantification. So if you have some figures you can provide to us where we can actually see what the success of these programs have been, how many students have taken advantage, how many students cannot take advantage, that might be helpful. And to the extent that they're available on a campus-by-campus basis, that would be helpful.
We'll pull that together and get it to you.
Okay.
Thank you. Commissioner, when I look at the handout that you gave me about, well, I guess the second paragraph, there's a bullet point where it says Minnesota ranks 34th nationally in retention from the first to second year in college. So 34th doesn't sound very good. I guess, do you have some views on why that is? Is it because we're not doing a very good job, or is it because perhaps we just have a lot more students going to college than the average state, and so maybe, you know, the pool of students we have we're taking on is perhaps more challenging than the average state?
Mr. Chairman, I think you've hit upon two points. One is we are a high attending state, very high, ranked nationally probably second. But I think in addition to that, the cohort of students is changing very dramatically in Minnesota from what it used to be. It's no longer the same type of student cohort. You have many more adult students, and you have many more students of color. And I think it's fair to say our institutions have not yet been able to adapt to that as much as they need to. But I would, even though we have more people going, I think 34th nationally is not very laudable at all. We should be able to do better than that, a lot better.
Okay. Do you have any idea in terms of, like, if you look at North Hennepin, you know, do you know, say, what the percentage of students are that make it from first to second year there as opposed to other campuses? I mean, can you rank it and say, well, yeah, they're doing 20% better? Maybe that's some of the information you'll get us, but...
Yeah, we'll try to pull that out, knowing specifically what you're looking for there, yes.
Okay, all right. Other questions? Senator Cohen.
Chairman and Commissioner, you talked about the utilization of other groups. You mentioned College Possible. I think you also mentioned the private colleges. Was that correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I think under the language, the way Senate has written it, I take it that, like line 1534, Minnesota State College and Universities and Private Organization Program. I would think that would include non-public colleges.
And I understand that's in the Senate language. That's not something that you had thought of, but that's not something that you might have anticipated when you worked with the governor. Is that...
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, actually, the governor's original language was broader. We anticipated whoever came in with the best ideas would get the grants. So we did anticipate, the governor did anticipate non-public colleges, even the University of Minnesota, if that made sense.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, how would that work with a private school? What would you anticipate?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I think you'd look at colleges that are, you know, you're probably not looking at McAllister and Carleton, because they have such a selective process, and the students they choose are likely to succeed. But I think you look at your Augsburgs, your Hamlins, St. Kate's maybe, and they're struggling with their gaps just as Minsku is. They just don't have as many students. And so if you could show that you could close the gaps on those campuses too, I think you'd want to do that. But having said all that, it is very clear that the major challenge in Minnesota is at the Minsku campuses, because that's where most of the students are, and most of the students of color at the Minsku campuses.
Mr. Chair.
And there, one final point. And Minsku campuses are, let me state the obvious, maybe it's not obvious to everybody here, but they're open enrollment, whereas the non-publics in the University of Minnesota are not open enrollment. They choose the students they basically want. And in that screening, their ability to be successful for those students is increased, whereas Minsku, particularly the community colleges, if you've got a high school diploma, you can get in.
Senator Fischbach.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Pogue-Miller, given the statements that you just made, then I would assume that you would not support the language that says 50% of the grant dollars must be awarded to private organizations.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, we obviously can work with that, I think. So I think that was a selection the Senate made.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Pogue-Miller, I would, if we come to it, I would think that we would all want that removed, given that you said the biggest challenges are Minsku schools. So to send 50% of the money, almost automatically to private organizations that, through your statements yourself, said that they're not struggling quite as much, I think that would make sense. If we are going to spend this money, it should be directed towards Minsku schools.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, in the context of the Senate language, it's not private colleges that have. It's College Possible. It could be all these other groups that are working with these populations. So I think you need to take that into context.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Pogue-Miller, I appreciate that. I'm just kind of, I think that automatically saying 50%, I mean, it does say to the extent possible, but when you do start talking about the challenges of Minsku, and they are, I mean, they are our responsibility. we fund them, and they are the Minnesota school system. I would think that we would want to, as much as possible, focus the monies there. And do you know, Commissioner Pogemiller, what percentage of the students at MinSU schools? I know you maybe you don't have those numbers, but what percentage of students of color do we have at those schools overall?
I think, my name is Nikki Oliver, legislative liaison for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I believe at two-year colleges at MinSU, about 70% of African Americans end up going to those schools, and about 67% of Hispanic students go to the two-year MinSU colleges, so a large percentage of students of color who graduate high school, who go to college, end up at a MinSU institution.
So Senator Fischbach.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, with those percentages, I mean, we obviously should be, if we're going to make this money work and really do what we want it to do, I think it should be focused on those places where we have high percentages.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, I absolutely agree with that. The point I was trying to make is the other 50% isn't non-public colleges. The other 50% is nonprofits that are supporting students in most likelihood that are going to MinSU campuses. So I think there's no doubt that the bulk of this money is going to end up in some form or fashion for students who are at MinSU campuses.
Senator Fischbach.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, Commissioner Pogemiller, when Senator Cohen asked about a definition of private organization programs online, 15.34, you did include definition of private colleges.
Mr. Chairman, I think it is included in that.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's not all going to the programs you mentioned, it doesn't necessarily, because the language that I'm looking at is on 16.17 and 16.18. So I guess maybe the definition is an issue of it because, or the private organization programs, because I would like to see if we're really going to do it, is have that money go to MinSU. If this is going to be, because we obviously have large populations there, they do educate the vast majority of not only our minority students, but our students in general in the state of Minnesota. So,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more that the money should be directed to the students. But just keep in mind, those students can be in all kinds of campuses, and that student doesn't really care what institution they're at. They just care that they get their diploma.
Yeah, Commissioner, I know this isn't your language, so we're kind of asking you to reach a little bit when it comes to these private groups. But I guess, you know, you're going to get us some data on MinSU, and I imagine you have a lot of data there. How much do we know about some of these private groups like TRIO or College Possible and such that you mentioned? I mean, what sort of a success rate do they have? I would gather that they represent only a tiny minority of students they're helping versus the MinSU system.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's accurate. And I think there's some good data on some of those organizations. I think there may be an overestimate of how successful they are by the organizations themselves sometimes, which is typically the way it would go. But I think there's some real good evidence on the TRIO programs that they're successful, and the WALEN. And I'm only mentioning those because those are the ones mentioned in the Senate. And there's no predisposition that they get it in the language, but those are the ones that senators talked about. Those are the likely suspects that would show up with grant applications.
And can you say a little bit more about the TRIO program and the WALEN program? I have to confess, I'm really not familiar with them.
The WALEN program?
Yeah. Or TRIO. And TRIO.
Mr. Chairman, TRIO is funded, it's a federally funded program by and large, and it's on a lot of campuses, a lot of our two-year campuses, a lot of our four-year campuses. So that would be to beef up whatever is happening with their current cohort of students. College Possible is a program that the legislature already directly funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have some documentation of what they've been able to accomplish. The WALEN program is after Wynn WALEN, mm-hmm. Who put his personal private money into a foundation to support, I believe he started out just with Minneapolis students, but I think he's now Minneapolis and St. Paul, if I'm not mistaken. And they've got some good data on their success, too. And they're mostly, the Wallen and the College Possible have mostly been in the access game, getting students into colleges, but they're transitioning now to this retention activity, too, because they found out from some of their data that just getting the student on campus isn't enough because they're dropping out. And so now they're moving to more programming related to the students they got on campus, keeping them on campus for the required amount of time.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just inside yourself, probably a little bit dangerous to start identifying programs that we as individual legislators have been involved with. But Senator Bonhoeff and I had exposure a couple of years ago to the College Possible program, and we're impressed, and not so much, we're impressed with what they were doing with college students, but as the name suggests, College Possible, what was attractive for us initially was in the context of talking about achievement gap at the elementary end. They did have some pretty good success with working with students to make sure they were ready for college. And so they were working with secondary students, and the program has been successful enough that originally it was aimed, it's grown exponentially in terms of geography, where it was originally aimed at the urban centers, then to suburban schools. And over the last, I think, year to 2 years, they've started to work extensively in greater Minnesota.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Pogel-Miller, I think that this may give us the opportunity to tighten up that language, just to make sure that we all have the same definition, because, I mean, private organization programs, when I initially looked at it in the first time we saw this, meant something different than private colleges to me. So maybe it's something that we should define a little better, given that we do have the opportunity to here in conference committee, but that's something we should look at, I think, given we're putting significant money into it.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner?
If the Senate wants to alter their language, that's fine with us. I would just say the key element here is to have the idea the governor put in the grant program was to create some accountability for results. And that's, you'd build that into the grant applications and just say, okay, what do you say you're going to deliver? How many students? And then you give out the grant.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just an aside, the Commissioner Pogel-Miller took the words out of my mouth as a former senator. We both wanted to remind Senator Fischbach she's a Senate referee.
And Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is possibly work together to find some language that everybody understands the definition of. And if
I was kidding you.
Okay.
Take it easy.
Any other questions for Commissioner Pogel-Miller?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make one.
Yes, absolutely.
I just want to reiterate this point. The governor's judgment that you needed both general operating money for MNSCU as well as some of this grant money. And that is in the Senate proposal. And I would just encourage you to consider that, because if they're cutting budgets at the same time you're trying to get them to close the gaps, you may not be successful.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're going to go to corrections, because if they only gave us time, it makes sense to you. Yeah, I think so. At least that's what Denny did.
You guys want to talk about this? No.
Yeah, well, but if you have something you want to do.
Okay. All right.
Okay, why are they here? I don't think they're here anyway. Are they? Okay.
All right. I think we're going to go next to the corrections department. And I believe the commissioner's here. Is that right?
There he is.
There he is. And whoever else you want to bring down, sir. Let's see, where are the spreadsheets for this? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, we got lots of paper to sift through here. Well, Commissioner, welcome to the Supplemental Finance Committee, and I am sorry, I know I've met you before, but I forget your name.
My name is Lisa Wojcik. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at Department of Corrections.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner Wojcik. Would you like to first make any kind of statement about the governor's proposal or anything else in particular before we go to some questions?
Mr. Chair, committee members, good evening. Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. We have put forward a proposal aligned with the governor, a very conservative proposal that should address population issues. It addresses essential items that we need to keep operating and addresses issues that have received a lot of attention lately, and we can specifically talk about employee compensation as our number one priority. The governor has put forward $13.2 million, and the assistant commissioner can talk about the impact of that particular supplemental budget for compensation.
All right, Assistant Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, our employee compensation request is to fund salaries for current employees. This does not add additional employees. This is funding we need to keep the people that currently work for us, keep our ability to pay them. We did not receive enough money in the last legislative session, and there were costs that we were not funded for, such as increased employer-paid insurance and some of the across-the-board increases negotiated in the labor agreements.
The Challenge Incarceration Program additionally is funded, and that is a prison early release program that reduces recidivism. And the request is for $5.77 million. Our Minnesota Choice Victim Notification is a one-time $1 million expenditure. It's an automated system to notify victims of prisoner status and prisoner release.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I just want to let members know this is in your last tab, and the appropriations are going down on page R3 if you want to go to that particular section. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Additionally, the next major initiative for us is infectious disease management. Many of our prisoners have significant health problems, and one of those is hepatitis C, and the additional $5.6 million will deal with the prescription drugs as well as additional nurses and a very important subject area for our system.
We also have a request for $4 million for information and technology. This is for staff to help mitigate our obsolescence issues that we have with many of our systems within our agency.
We also have a request for $3.5 million for additional corrections officers and therapists to deal with our mental health treatment at Oak Park Heights, our maximum security prison. Many of you know that mental health in jails and prisons is a significant issue, and in this particular facility, we have some individuals that need very significant intervention for their mental health concerns.
We also have a request for to add 24-hour nursing to four of our correctional facilities. Currently, we do not have 24-hour nursing in all of our facilities.
The legislative auditor regarding those nursing services in a major report on our medical services about 2 years ago indicated a very significant need to have those 24-hour nursing services, and we feel it's very important. We have also
in terms of security staffing, and the governor has also recognized that additional correctional officers are important. We just completed a National Institute of Corrections staffing analysis. We have had concerns about staffing in many of our facilities, and we wanted to do a very legitimate, a very thorough study of our staffing patterns and our staffing complement. And actually, the request for these 50 officers is about half of what that study actually showed that we need. And the last item on the governor's proposal here, and we significantly have a gap in our electronic health records. Currently, we have a manual system, and actually statute requires that we have an automated system. And this, again, was an area that the legislative auditor identified as very important for us to have. And those are our conservative proposals, and we are ready to answer inquiries.
All right. Well, Commissioner, maybe I can just start. I may just run down the R3 language, but starting with the employee compensation, is, you know, I know that last year we adopted the governor's recommendation when it came to employee compensation for correctional institutions, except I think that we did not, well, I'm not sure we ended up on this in the end, but I know that at least on the House side, we didn't put in the money for the additional employees in the food service area that were being converted to state employees, because frankly, we've been told that it was going to happen whether we did it or not. So we thought, well, you know, there's only so much money to go around. Why should we spend money here? But leaving that aside, I guess I'm puzzled that we would have done the recommendation of the governor and now have the governor coming back asking for $13 million in additional compensation for the same number of employees. So can you tell us a little bit more about what happened? I mean, why are we in a situation where the money we gave last year that was what was requested is not enough?
Mr. Chair, committee members, you have asked the identical question that your counterparts in the Senate asked last week, I believe. And I attempted to answer that question, and also Commissioner Franz from MMB did a far more thorough analysis and presentation stating what the reason for that is. And in a very, very simple terms, when the budget was put forward, it did not include contract settlements that have settled in the period between then and now. And that those contract settlements, those benefit increases, all are reflected here.
Commissioner, didn't the governor make some estimate, though, of what the settlements would be when he made the request last year?
Mr. Chair, I cannot speak to that particular issue on what estimates the governor made. Perhaps there were discussions between the governor and MMB, but I was certainly not part of those. And as I told the Senate committee, MMB really is the master controller of contract settlements in this state. And those strategies are developed within that department, and there are actually specialists within MMB that Commissioner Franz testified that he had on board that deal with contract settlements and contract estimations. So I feel that I'm not answering your question, but again, I don't know at all.
So Commissioner, I guess maybe I can ask it in another way. So is this $13 million, is this the difference between the actual settlement and the governor's estimate, or is this just the total increase in compensation, so that there was no estimate at all last year for any raises, and now we're basically paying for all the raises. Assistant Commissioner Wojcik.
Mr. Chair, they did make an estimate, and that estimate was not enough to cover the across-the-board increases settled in the contracts, and included in that is also the employer-paid insurance increases. For beginning January 1st of 2016, it was almost a 7% increase, and for January 1st of 2017, it's almost a 10% increase. So not only was it the across-the-board increases, but it's also the employer-paid insurance, which doesn't necessarily get negotiated in line with the biennial budget process.
And, Commissioner, I guess when I would look at this, is there any way to divide this out and say that, you know, a certain percentage of this $13 million are the correctional institutions and a certain percentage are the home office and a certain percentage are other programs? Do you have any sort of a division in that way?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do, and we do not have that on the table at present time, but we certainly can, and we often present our budgets in those divisions as well. And I actually believe your budget book is broken up in those different departments.
Okay, well, if you could provide that information to us, Assistant Commissioner.
I do have that information.
All right.
Because it's broken up out in the spreadsheet. For the facilities division, it's $11.739 million. For the community services division, it's $1.101 million. And for operation support, it's $402,000. So a majority of that is for our correctional facilities. And I would add in the community services division, a lot of those employees provide supervision services in the community and our essential personnel. I would also add our operations support division is extremely small for this large of an agency, and even a $400,000 hit is a really big hit.
Okay. Any other questions on that subject? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, I'm just curious, so how much were we off on our estimation? In my budget area, I believe there was an allowance made, and I'm wondering, did you miss it by 10%, 20%, by 100%? If we're $13 million short, what was anticipated to cover your increased costs for the biennium?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McNamara, the estimated increase was 3%. Our need for fiscal year 16 was 4.79%. And due to compounding in fiscal year 17, it's 5.03%.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. And Assistant Commissioner, how does that equate into this is a $13 million supplemental? How much was actually anticipated? How did you gave me what the actual percentage. I was curious to the dollars. Did we only estimate half the actual cost? I'm trying to understand that. Do you follow my question?
But I mean, the $13 million, as I understand it, is the difference between the 3% and the roughly 5%, then. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And Representative McNamara.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And did I miss how much of it is the health care cost of the 13? Did you pull out, you said percentage increases for health care, but what of the $13 million is attributed to health care?
Mr. Chair, members, in total, the insurance increases for the agency were about $9.2 million. That's total agency, so it's not the difference between what we received last year and what we're asking for this year.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, if you at some point could just, I'm just curious, of the 13, X amount is for benefits and Y amount was actually the increases that were evidently negotiated larger by the administration than they originally thought they were going to negotiate. And just so I have that right, Mr. Chair, for the record, this was the governor anticipating what he was going to negotiate, and then he negotiated significantly more, evidently, and is now coming back to let us know that he negotiated more than what he anticipated, I'm assuming.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members, It sounds like a significant amount. I understand that. Our agency is very unique compared to other agencies where we are 96% funded with general fund dollars. And of our general fund dollars, about 75% of that is for employee compensation. We are very, very employee heavy. So it is very expensive for us anytime there are any increases negotiated in regards to insurance or with the labor negotiations. So a 2% increase to me, even though it's $13 million, 2% is not an exorbitant difference from what the original estimation was. And being that we are open 24 hours a day and 365 days a year, and we have posts that have to be covered, it is really very critical that we get this funding.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. If there aren't any other questions on that subject, let me just move the challenge incarceration expansion. That, if I remember right, that's adding a certain number of beds up in Willow River and Togo. Is that right? How many beds is that?
Mr. Chair, it's 130 beds between those two facilities. Actually, that includes also an expansion at Lino Lakes that's not related to the challenge incarceration program. So our bed addition is about 130 beds totally.
So in total, the governor's package or proposal was 130 more beds.
That's correct, 135 actually. And okay. Those are within existing facilities and reconfiguring existing buildings.
And the Senate is funding the Willow River and Togo portion of that. Is the Lino part, are they just doing that themselves out of their other sources?
Actually, that's a bonding request.
Oh, that's a bonding request. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. If I can move next to the infectious disease management then. I mean, clearly you're treating people for these now. Have you had a big increase in these diseases that are causing more issues, or what in particular brings you forward with this sort of initiative this year, Assistant Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, one of the biggest issues is with hepatitis C, and there have been new drugs developed that actually can cure hepatitis C. Because these drugs are so new, however, they are very, very expensive. And we are required to provide a community level of care. And so we would be required to provide these medications and cure people of hepatitis C. And this is also a health issue for the whole state of Minnesota. You know, if we can work on eradicating hepatitis C, and we have a high population of inmates with hepatitis C, you know, it's a good thing for the state in general, because as you all know, most offenders get out of prison at some time.
Yeah, I guess you remind me of this in terms of, yeah, I have heard about the high cost of, I think there's one drug in particular to treat hepatitis C that's very high priced, that I think, you know, on the human services healthcare side, we're kind of struggling a little bit with what to do on that too. Yeah, I'll recall that now. So the 24-hour nursing, moving on to that, do we have 24-hour coverage at all the other facilities but the four that are listed, Shakopee, St. Cloud, Lino, and Stillwater?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to leave my seat and give it to Deputy Commissioner Terry Carlson, who has responsibility for health services within our prisons.
Okay. Deputy Carlson, welcome to the Supplemental Conference Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was, do we have 24-hour coverage at all other facilities beyond these four? And the answer is no. We have 24-hour nursing coverage at our Faribault facility and at our Oak Park Heights facility currently. And this request is to add coverage at four additional facilities: St. Cloud, Lino Lakes, Stillwater, and Shakopee.
Okay. And what sort of situations have you had that have caused you to feel you need this now when you didn't have it before?
Mr. Chair, thanks for that question. We used to have 24-hour nursing coverage until the early 2000s at most of our facilities, and because of budget issues, we had to stop with that coverage. Right now, we have coverage from about 6 in the morning until about 10 at night at our facilities. And so, especially at the four facilities that I've mentioned earlier, there's a high number of inmates who have ongoing chronic and critical medical issues that would be well served to have a nursing staff on duty to attend to questions and issues that arise with those men and women, chronic conditions like diabetes and seizures and all those kinds of things happen right now in our facilities on an ongoing and very frequent basis. And our security staff are trained as first responders and can administer CPR. But beyond that, it's calls to on-call doctors, on-call nurses, and trips to emergency rooms. Anytime we take an inmate off grounds, especially in the middle of the night when we're very low staffed already, it creates pretty big security issues for our facilities. And so having these additional staff on duty to attend to medical issues that arise is cost efficient and very helpful for the tough work that the corrections officers have to do.
So, I mean, and if you have an incident, I mean, someone has a seizure right now at 3 in the morning, they're taken to the local hospital. The local hospital bills the Department of Corrections, I assume. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So does this $1.5 million figure in the savings that you're going to be presumably having by no longer having so many hospital trips?
It would be difficult to quantify that, and quite frankly, I don't know that there would be savings. It would be mostly avoided costs. But we wouldn't see, like, our health service budget is chronically underfunded, and it would just help with that a bit.
Okay. Any other questions on any of these subjects? Okay, let me move to the next one that's on my list, and that's the behavioral health and mental health therapists at Oak Park Heights. I guess the Senate had about $1.5 million, I think. Did you say that the governor's proposal was $3 million? I guess I forget.
Mr. Chair, yes. The governor's budget was for $3.53 million at Oak Park Heights for mental health treatment. That would have increased mental health treatment not only in our mental health unit, but also in our administrative control unit, which is sometimes referred to generally as restrictive segregation, restrictive housing.
What do they have for mental health services at Oak Park Heights right now?
We currently have, Mr. Chair, we currently have a mental health unit for the most serious, persistent, mentally ill inmates. And a big component of the governor's request is to add more corrections officers and treatment staff so that the inmates who are in that unit can get out to programming, participate in classes in a very safe way.
Okay. And then you talked about hiring 50 officers basically across the system for increased security staffing. How does that compare to, I mean, is this a case where you maybe cut some staffing some years ago also and respond to, as you did, say, in the nursing area, or is this just additional staff that you think you need?
Mr. Chair, it's staff that we need. Our duties and responsibilities have grown significantly. We have put more inmates in our facilities to eke out every nook, cranny, and closet and make it into a place where an offender can live, and we've done that with adding very few additional staff. We have a high number of staff who take inmates off grounds for medical appointments and hospital trips, and the request is to help fill some of those gaps. Right now, we ensure adequate staffing at our facilities by either hiring overtime when we don't have enough staff on duty, or closing down existing programs, and that's not a good way to operate a correctional facility.
See, the you also mentioned the victim notification system. I know there's $1 million. I think it's $1 million request there. Can you talk about that? I understand that that's some sort of equipment or something that's replacing a current system.
Mr. Chair,
Assistant Commissioner,
our victim notification system is hosted by a third-party vendor at this time. We had an issue with the system last April. And it's supposed to be a public-facing system where victims can go and register for the information that they would like to receive on the offenders that were their perpetrators. However, we've had to shut that system down. It is no longer public-facing. We are having to do work manually, and we need to build a new system, and this is what the $1 million is for.
So there's no system at all right now?
We have a system, Mr. Chair, we have a system that is minimally operational, and we are working very closely with the vendor to try to get it to be operational. We think it is important for the agency to have its own system and not rely on this third-party vendor any longer.
Okay. And I guess last, I'd like to ask about the technology critical updates. I think, did you say you had asked for $3 million? Is that what it was?
Mr. Chair, yes. We asked for $3 million.
And is that a one-time request?
Mr. Chair, this year it is a one-time request. We will most likely be coming back and asking for technology money in our next biennial budget request.
I guess maybe I can ask you, Senator Cohen, not to put you on the spot, but I know the Senate has got the $3 million, but then they also have ongoing appropriations of $783,000 a year after that. I guess do you or does anyone, you know, of your team have any more information on what those out years are for?
Good question. Maybe I could ask Mr. Turner if that'd be okay.
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Turner, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, the $783 entails each year represents what we understand is we had some extra money in our tails target, and we understood that this was requested by the governor as a one-time appropriation, but they're going to come back next year, and these are positions. And they're going to be ongoing. So with the money we had left over in our tails target, Senator Latz decided to, and the Senate decided to slot in a little over $750,000 each year, and recognize that real cost.
Okay, but Assistant Commissioner, the governor's request was only for $3 million. Was there anticipated to be some ongoing cost here?
Mr. Chair, we wanted to see how much we could get done in a year and come up with a really good number for what we need for ongoing permanent staff. Sometimes we can augment with contractors to try to get some of this work done, this obsolescence work done. We have our main operating system for all of our offender management, our COM system. There's 42 applications right now that are written in a language that is obsolete. And Microsoft will no longer be supporting that language, I believe, in sometime in 2017. And so we do need to do some work very, very quickly, as much as we can, on those critical applications. From there, we are going to reanalyze and determine what our permanent staffing need is. It may not be $3 million on a permanent basis, but there will be a need.
Mr. Turner.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. I'd just like to point out the original request, the governor's request was $4 million, and the Senate pared it back.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Other questions for the Assistant Commissioner? And I don't know if I have any other questions for the Corrections Department myself. Are there any other questions for other items that I didn't bring up or ask questions about? Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I could ask the Commissioner to So, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, kind of a comment and a question. We had this discussion fairly extensively. Obviously, you had it within Senator Lass's division. But when Mr. Chairman, I just might indicate for yourself that when we got into some of these questions about compensation, as the Commissioner pointed out, then that a lot of this was taking place at the level of MMB. And so I think I've just mentioned to you that I think at some point we probably should try to have Commissioner Franz available to us to get into a discussion on an administration-wide basis in terms of where some of these problems take place. So I just want to clarify, Commissioner, because I, again, you made the point, as was made by Commissioner Franz in the Senate, but it wasn't a question what the legislature did or not, did not do last year. Some of these issues developed subsequent to last year's session. And I just want to make sure that we're clear on that. That's something I understand we had from Commissioner Franz. Because at the outset, you talked about not being getting the full appropriation request from last year.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you added that clarity, and that is exactly right.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's why I suggest, in fact, Senator Fischbach and I had conversations during the course of Senate deliberations where Commissioner Franz became was made available. We asked that he come to address these questions directly. But I do want to make clear that I think the legislature, Senate and House, appropriated what was needed for compensation in the agencies. Again, there certainly might be room for conversation as to these appropriations, the level of the appropriations, and the area of appropriations. But I do think that the legislature met the needs, and I think everybody recognizes, I'd like to think everybody recognizes, that there's some fairly unique needs and situations in the Department of Corrections. You don't shut the doors at 5:30 or 6 o'clock at night and everybody goes home, because you have a lot of folks who remain there overnight.
We do shut the doors, yes.
And we lock them.
But not everybody goes home.
They are home.
Yeah.
For now.
So that's why, Mr. Chairman, I suggest that we should at some point have Commissioner Franz to speak to us to these issues on a somewhat broader basis.
And thank you, Senator Cohen. I think that makes sense. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Roy, I'm just curious. I kind of put things into perspective for the agencies that I have in my purview. How many employees are in the corrections agency? Full-time equivalents, if you don't mind me asking.
Full-time equivalents?
Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, approximately 4,300.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, thank you very much. Any last words, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I always take the opportunity to remind those that I speak to that relative to other departments in the country, we fall in the bottom five of cost per 100,000 population. We are a very small department, not only in size of our inmates and the people that we supervise in the community, but we are very small in proportion to the state general fund, and consistently we are held up as an example of a very efficient agency. And I just felt compelled to tell you that.
Well, thank you. And I know many of the employees, and I know that you have a difficult job. I guess before you go, I should ask a couple questions just looking to the future. I know that you've got a number of your inmates that are actually housed in county jails now as opposed to in our regular facilities. About how many inmates, state inmates, do we have that are housed in county jails at the present time?
Mr. Chair, I believe we have today about 465. It hovers around 500. That is a situation, as you know, that we are not comfortable with, and we believe we have a good strategy to deal with that that does not involve major construction. The governor felt that the $141 million expansion at Rush City was not something that he wanted to support, and I know there are people in this room that weren't necessarily supporting that as well. And he asked us to come up with some alternatives, and we believe we have. We expect the sentencing reforms that are moving through both houses in terms of the drug sentences should help us significantly. We are reviewing our hearings and release parole violator policies, and we bring about 2,800 of our 8,000 intakes come back every year as parole violators. We're trying to develop alternative strategies for those. We have mentioned our bonding proposals that should give us some extra beds, and the CIP expansion especially, we get a lot of bang for the buck with that strategy, and the Lino Lakes expansion very minimally. We always would like to hang our hat on good treatment. Mental health, chemical dependency treatment is bringing recidivism down and hopefully reducing the number of people returning to prison. So, we're working hard on it, and I think we're going to get it accomplished.
And what are your projections right now in terms of how many additional, without the sentencing reforms that are, you know, somewhat up in the air, I guess, you know, if you look out several years, what are your projections about how many more inmates you'll have?
With everything status quo, we will need about 1,000 more beds in 4 to 5 years.
And that does not include the 500 that are in the county jails right now?
That does include the 500.
That does include the 500. So in 4 or 5 years, you'll need an additional 1,000 beds. And I think, and what about 7, 8 years? Is it maybe another 300 beyond that or something?
Mr. Chair, you have those numbers right.
All right. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, next we're going to go to the Commissioner of Human Services, if she could come down.
Oh, go ahead. Sure, that's fine.
All right, let me recognize Senator Cohen.
So, Mr. Chairman, there are a couple comments before the commissioner begins to speak and present testimony to the conference committee. We spent a decent amount of time with these issues. Obviously, Senator Lurie and Senator Fischbach being on the division are much more conversant with these issues than I am. But when Senator Lurie and I talked during the promulgation of his article for the supplemental bill, I told Senator Lurie that I would spend some time with the department trying to get a sense on some of these direct care and treatment issues. And so I had a couple meetings with the commissioner, had material sent to me, and accepted the argument that the agency, the commissioner, was making. I will tell you that if you look at the Senate bill, the commissioner would tell you that it's not adequate for the agency's purposes. Commissioner, and I had, you know, if I'm allowed to kind of divide this into the three parts, and Senator Lurie, correct me if, and Commissioner, correct me if I'm wrong, that you had two $14 million segments, and then the $50 million segment totaling of $43 million. What I indicated to the commissioner is that I was very accepting of the $28 million. Had some questions about the additional amount as to the need to do it in this supplemental bill as opposed to doing it in January, February of next year. What I told the commissioner, what I told Senator Lori is I would try to cover as much as I could of that 28. Did not come up with the entire amount, came up with 17. And I had actually looked, had talked to the administration, not agency, but the administration, about whether or not there might be some other way to come up with some additional resources, and made it clear that if I could come up with those resources, I wouldn't put it to other purposes in the budget. I would use it directly for this, even if it was coming from MMB or someplace other. So that's one comment. The second comment is, I think the governor has made clear over and over again in meetings with many of us and with meetings with the majority leader and the speaker, if I'm not mistaken, that his, I don't know if he would say this is his single priority, but it's one of his two or three priorities this year in the entirety of the budget, is to take care of the concerns at Human Services. So I'm not going to speak for the governor other than to repeat what he has said, and he's not made any threats in the process of that, but makes clear over and over again that this is what's very, very essential to his administration.
And I guess, Senator Cohen, what I would say is, you know, I think we were a little bit perplexed on the House on what to do on some of these areas. They are certainly very important areas, and we recognize that these are critical security functions for the state. But if I could focus in on St. Peter, for example, and the hospital there, I assume that in 2013-14, with the state all being run by one party and the governor being of that party, that the hospital in St. Peter, the Minnesota State Hospital, got the funding amount that they were requesting. And in 2015, we came in, and the very first major bill we were faced with was a deficiency bill where the hospital's asking for $10 or $11 million. And we thought about it some, had hearings, and then gave them their request of $10 or $11 million as a deficiency to that 2014-15 year. Then last year, we, I believe, gave the department what they were requesting for the hospital down in St. Peter, and now we come back this year and we're faced with another request of, I think it's, what is it, $22 million remaining for 2016 and 17. And so I guess I'm just perplexed that this hospital, and not, I'm not picking in any sense on the people that are there, I guess we're just puzzled that we're told that a certain amount of money is needed, that money is appropriated, then we're told there's a deficiency and there's more money needed, and that money's appropriated, and then we're told, well, our budget for this next year, next 2 years, is going to be this, and that money's appropriated, and now we're back again with a request for more money. And so I guess we're just puzzled by this, and we know it's a critical security hospital. We know the people that are working there are working under very difficult circumstances, and you know, none of the things I'm saying are in any way meant to say anything bad about that. We're just puzzled about these continuing new requests for money when we thought we had given what was requested. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly why you and I discussed wanting to have the agency in front of us this evening, so we're all hearing the same thing. I think, you know, one of the difficulties with any of the stuff we do around here is obviously Representative Dean and Senator Lori are quite knowledgeable. And Senator Fischbach, obviously, also is a member of Senator Lori's division. But the two respective chairs have listened to this, I won't say over and over again. I won't speak for either one of them. But I assume have spent lots of time delving into the issues of the agency, St. Peter, Anoka, and so on. But I think that's why you and I think, agreed it would be useful.
Absolutely.
To have the agency here, so we're all hearing this at the same time.
Senator Lori.
Yeah, and I think Senator Cohen described the process we went through in the Senate of putting together the Health and Human Services articles well, and I kind of said, look, we have the basically $43 million of deficiency and operating adjustments, and that's for
you know, costs for what we thought we bought last year, and I'm going to turn that over to Cohen and leadership just to decide what we do with and tell me what to put in the target there. And so we've been going back and forth, and we came up with $17 million of the $28 million amount for the deficiency in the Senate proposal, and we haven't yet funded the operating adjustment. But in recognition that this is really, and the administration has continued to say that this is one of their really high priorities. And so from my perspective, when we come together, it's a three-way negotiation. For a bill to become a law, it has to pass the House, it has to pass the Senate, and it has to get signed by the governor. And so as we step through the House proposals and then step through the Senate proposals and looked at what was on the table, there was some pieces that were highlighted that the administration felt pretty strongly that we make sure are discussed and on the table and have the full benefit of their input. And so I think this is useful, and I thank you for setting up this time to give them the opportunity to give the pitch for that that's not either in the House or the Senate.
All right. Well, without further ado, Commissioner, welcome to the Supplemental Conference Committee. And I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
That's okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Alex Kutz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the department.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Well, do you want to make your presentation?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Emily Piper, Commissioner of Human Services. And first, I just want to start by saying thank you for having us here tonight. I really focused this presentation on the needs within direct care and treatment area of our agency that aren't fully reflected in the Senate position or the House position, to make sure that we were clear about why we think these needs are priorities and necessities for our agency. And just to explain, if we don't receive this funding, we will have to make systemic changes across direct care and treatment, our entire system, to account for continuing to try and operate as many of the programs and do as much of the work as we possibly can. So I thought it would be good for us to sort of step back and explain at a really high level what we're talking about here. And direct care and treatment in DHS is about half of our employees, and it's about 3,500 of our 6,400 employees in our agency, but it's less than 5% of our budget. We serve about 12,000 people across our direct care and treatment area every year. That includes our state sex offender program, which is about 720 men and one woman. It includes our campus at St. Peter. It includes our forensic nursing home. It includes a whole bunch of stuff, but we're really focused on four different programs tonight that we're really concerned about within direct care and treatment. The first are our community behavioral health hospitals. And these are 16-bed hospitals. We have seven of them currently located all across the state. They're in Annandale, Alexandria, Baxter, Bemidji, Fergus Falls, Rochester, and St. Peter. And these hospitals really serve people with mental health issues. Most of them are committed to the Commissioner of Human Services as mentally ill. And then we have our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, and that's our main hospital in our system. We currently have a patient census that hovers anywhere between 96 and 100 patients at any given time. Those are people, about half of whom come from jail in mental health crisis, really acute mental health crisis, and about half come from hospitals all across the state. And they're people that private hospitals, if it's community hospitals or the Fairviews or the Alinas of the world, can't manage those patients. They need the most high-level acute psychiatric care. And then we have Minnesota Security Hospital. And Minnesota Security Hospital is where people who are committed to the Commissioner of Human Services as mentally ill and dangerous go. And at any given time, there's about 380 people down at Security Hospital committed to me as mentally ill and dangerous. In addition to that, there are currently 37 people down in Security Hospital that are in what's called our Competency Restoration Program. We have Competency Restoration at St. Peter at the Security Hospital, and we have some people at Anoka, at our Anoka Hospital, that are, they are with They're committed to my care so that they can have their competency restored to stand trial for crimes that they've committed. They've been determined incompetent by courts. They come to us to try and regain competency. This is all in addition to the patients that we have at our forensic nursing home, in our transitions program down at Security Hospital, which is where people go out to try and learn to transition back into the community, and in addition to our state sex offender program, which is down at St. Peter on the same campus as the Security Hospital, and then up in Moose Lake, Minnesota. And then finally, we have our MNSOCS program, our Minnesota State Operated Community Services program, and that is about 117 group homes all across the state where people live. They were designed to be four-person group homes. Some of them have four people in them. Some have less than four people in them. And most of the people that are in those group homes are suffering from really significant developmental disabilities, and they have behaviors, many of them, that make them not good candidates for private providers to provide care for them, so they come to us. And of the patients that are in our group homes, many of them, over 100 of them, are also committed to me as wards of the state. So I am not only caring, our staff is not only caring for them, providing them housing to live in, but I'm also the public guardian to those people. So that is really the landscape of who we're talking about and the programs that we're talking about when we're talking about the concerns between the Senate position, the House position, and what the governor's recommendations are. And you touched, Mr. Chair, on Security Hospital, and I just wanted to sort of set the table so that everybody had an understanding of who these people are. So tonight I'm focused on our top three priorities of the governor's direct care and treatment crisis package. And first and foremost, that's stabilizing funding, it's improving clinical capacity and quality, and it's aiding movement through our system. And as you all know, we do have other priorities that are and aren't reflected in the various positions of the bodies that were before today. First, the stabilizing the funding for the MSOCs deficiency. So when I became commissioner in December, MSOCs, those are those group homes, those 117 group homes all across the state, were $14 million in deficit, with another $14 million deficit projected by the end of the biennium. And so we are seeking $28 million to pay for the services that we are already providing to these people. While we're talking about the services in terms of dollars and cents, it's important to remember that these are homes with really, really vulnerable people in them. And as I said, many of these people have aggressive behaviors that make them unable to be placed in private providers. And so when we're talking about this population, many of whom who have lived in the same group homes for 20 and 30 years, we need to be very sensitive to how we move carefully. We need to move carefully. They're really vulnerable. Any changes that we make to this program, we need to be thoughtful and strategic and first and foremost concerned about the vulnerabilities, the people living in the homes, and then also making sure that if and when we make a change to the program, that they're transitioned in a way that is that provides them the safety and the transitioning that they need because of the vulnerable condition that they're in. So because it's not a full budget session, and because we need to be very thoughtful about how we're transitioning funding for this program going forward, we're seeking $28 million for this biennium with the plan that we would come back next year in a budget year and bring forth a proposal that would address the long-term funding stability issues that we are experiencing in our MSOCS program. So there aren't tails on this $28 million, but it really is, there aren't tails because we need to come with a comprehensive plan, and right now we're just trying to maintain funding sufficient for us to continue to run the program through the rest of the biennium. Our second request relating to stabilization of funding is funding or operating adjustment. And the governor's budget recommendation includes $14.9 million in FY 16 and 17 to fully fund the staffing increases that are going to take effect this summer. And these increases are relating to the bargaining increases in mental health and our sex offender program. Our operating adjustments proposed for DHS cover about 40% of all of our employees. It's focused on these direct care areas, most of which provide 24/7 care to Minnesotans across the state, similar to what Commissioner Roy was speaking to with the Department of Corrections, that it's not a 9-to-5 job in these facilities. And so those are the employees that we're seeking to maintain our staff complement for. If we don't receive this funding, we will need to reduce our staff complement for direct care and treatment by an estimated 130 full-time equivalent employees. So now when we talk about what the governor's proposal is for moving pieces, and Representative Dean saw this in his committee, I find this visual helpful, going through the plan as we see it and how the governor has proposed. So on this diagram, you can see the Anoka Hospital. It has funding for 110 beds, but really it's close to 100 beds because of patient acuity. We have more patients coming from jail than we did before, and we are licensed for 175 beds, but we only have funding for 110 beds, filling 110 beds. So we, down in the corner, we have the State Security Hospital. So the Security Hospital proposal proposes to add additional funding. It adds 335 full-time equivalent employees at Minnesota State Security Hospital by FY 2019. And I just want to recognize that the development of the Security Hospital proposal really different than years past has been an effort that has been led by the people down at Security Hospital, including the people here tonight, where the Bureau of Mediation Services came in over the summer and worked with the employees at Security Hospital to identify what their long-term staffing and other needs were. And the governor's position this session reflects what the staff down at Security Hospital, from the executive director to the nurses to the educators to the security counselors down there, believe is the ongoing funding need for that facility. And so they recommend 335 full-time employees. The plan is to close our community behavioral health hospital in St. Peter and our St. Peter Community Addiction Care Recovery Enterprise. That's our chemical dependency program. We have six facilities across the state. Would be moved to the CBHH that we close. That hospital would close. We would take our chemical dependency facility down there, and we would put it in the hospital. A new standalone competency restoration program would then be placed in what is now this chemical dependency program facility. And we would then take some of the people who are at Anoka and at Security Hospital in this competency restoration program and put them in a separate facility. And at Anoka, this is especially important because those people that are currently at Anoka in our competency restoration program, many of them don't belong at Anoka anymore. And they don't need that hospital level of care. This takes them out of that facility where they clearly do not belong, and it moves them to a standalone competency restoration facility. And then that frees up about 20 beds at Anoka to provide hospitals all across the state with increased access to the resources available in Anoka. One of the biggest complaints and challenges that I've heard since I've become commissioner is that hospitals all across the state are very, very frustrated. As more patients come from jails to Anoka, it reduces their ability to access Anoka for the patients in acute psychiatric crisis that they have backing up in their emergency rooms. And so this wouldn't solve the whole challenge, but it would free up some beds to allow some of the 50 people currently on the waiting list to get into Anoka from hospitals across the state to have access to that to that hospital. We would add staff at Anoka to increase clinical oversight, establish a nurse float pool, and address citations that we have received from the federal government. We just recently entered into what's called a systems improvement agreement at Anoka with CMS. Our ability, because of patient care issues at Anoka, our ability to even bill the federal government for the services provided to our patients on Medicare was in jeopardy of being terminated. And so we entered into an agreement with CMS where we would make improvements to patient care at our hospital to maintain our ability to continue to be able to bill for services we provided and to improve patient care and provide patient care in the way we all want to provide it there. We would also, of the six remaining CBHHs, of the six remaining hospitals all across the state, we would increase the staffing at those hospitals to allow for more treatment time with patients, to get patients moving forward and through those hospitals faster, and then also staff them up so that they can fill their 16-bed capacity. Right now, of our community behavioral health hospitals, even though they have 16 beds, we only have funding to fund about 10 to 12 beds at any given time. So we literally have hospitals, mental health hospitals that are state-run hospitals with empty beds in them while patients in hospitals, all across private hospitals all across the state are backing up in emergency rooms. So this funding would allow us to fully maximize our footprint and staff up so we could take 16 patients at each of the six remaining community behavioral health hospitals. With that investment, we would add a net 12 beds, even with the closure of one of our community behavioral health hospitals. So that's what this moving pieces diagram is trying to describe, and trying to describe the connections between all of the different pieces. With regard to Anoka and our community behavioral hospitals, one of the biggest challenges is that we can't operate them at full capacity. We don't have the funding, as I said, to operate our 16-bed hospitals with 16 beds full. And so this proposal would increase inpatient psychiatric beds within DCT by making these changes that we think we need to staff up our hospital in the way, our Anoka hospital in particular, in a way that doesn't overly burden a limited number of staff, that provides the clinical oversight, the clinical resources that we think necessary to appropriately care for people at Anoka. And I would say, when I started in December as commissioner, we were at our Anoka hospital at over 12% mandated overtime for direct care staff. When I would visit the hospital, would visit with nurses, with health service technicians who are working 16-hour mandated shifts, double shifts, multiple times in a two-week pay period because we didn't have the staffing necessary to continue to sustain our staffing complement. And we were in sort of a negative feedback cycle where we were trying to hire staff as fast as we could, and staff were leaving so fast because they would be hired, they wouldn't be trained appropriately, they would get mandated into overtime shifts, and then they would leave. And so since I started as commissioner, we've reduced our overtime at Anoka by investing in the short term in additional staffing resources, including adding over 50 new employees to our staffing complement, which has resulted in us, for the first time since I became commissioner and over a year, where we haven't had any staff mandates. So we haven't had any staff be mandated to double shifts, which is a huge success, but we need the long-term investment to continue to sustain that staffing complement and avoid these issues of mandated staff overtime, and then also increases in OSHA reportable injuries, in part because we have tired staff working in some really challenging environments. Oh, yeah, and Ms. Kutza just pointed out to me, you know, I think one piece of the discussion that has, that sort of gets lost and clearly just got lost with me in this conversation is that at any given time, upwards of 30 of the 110 people at Anoka don't meet this hospital level of care. Many of them are these people that are coming from jail to get their competency restored that we want to move out of Anoka. Well, when a person doesn't need hospital level of care anymore, each county across the state that is charged with placing that person in Anoka ends up picking up the daily rate and paying the daily rate for that patient, which results in, on average, in excess of $60,000 worth of payments per day that counties across the state are making to the general fund for patients who are at Anoka, who don't need to be in Anoka, who shouldn't be at Anoka. And so I think that there is, although this is expensive, counties across the state are paying huge amounts of money to keep people at Anoka because they can't find other places to put them. And so that what we're doing now and how the system is working now, I guess my point is it's not without cost across across the state to counties. Our second proposal relates to our Minnesota Security Hospital Bureau of Mediation Services Work Group's recommendation. And it increases staffing to meet industry practice standards for safety and individualized treatment. It creates a specialized unit to address the needs of patients with developmental delays, replaces outdated equipment, and establishes positive behavioral support, expert teams, and an occupational health presence on the campus. Currently, our staffing ratio at Security Hospital is 2 staff for every 1 patient. And this staffing proposal would bring up the staff-to-patient ratio from that number to 2.86 staff to every 1 patient. And like hospitals across the country providing this care have staffing ratios closer to in between 3-1 and 3.3-1 staff to patient. So although it's very expensive, it is not out of bounds with what nationally and how nationally other like facilities are staffing this really challenging population of people, again, who are both mentally ill and dangerous, committed to the care of the Commissioner of Human Services. So this next slide really is just a reflection of where we are at as far as the Senate and the House position as it relates to the governor's position. The House position doesn't include any funding for direct care and treatment. The Senate bill includes $50 million, but it doesn't include full funding, as Senator Cohn and Senator Lori discussed, for either our deficiency in our state group homes or our operating adjustments. And I'm using this as an example, and I know I sent a letter to the conference committee as well to highlight that if the conference committee accepted the full Senate position, DHS would be left with just $7 million to do these really necessary improvements that we believe will affect needed change at Security Hospital and at Anoka and at our community behavioral hospitals. So essentially, the first $43 million of funding must go to continued operations of these group homes, as well as funding the staff we already have. And then any remainder of the money would be divvied up between Security Hospital, Anoka, and our community behavioral health hospitals to do what we could with the funding resources that were provided. And then finally, I appreciate that you're here to listen tonight to the importance of our direct care and treatment priority package, but I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention these two really other really important proposals that it appears aren't moving forward. And one is our monthly cash assistance grant for our MFIT program that has gone unchanged for 30 years, and our CCAP program's 12-month continued eligibility that would give families more stability and really make that program work for families, ensuring that 30,000 children each month have continued access to child care resources that they need. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Well, I'm sure there are several, but I guess let me just it appears that I see 130 FTEs that you want to in your stabilization area. I see
240 FTEs at the CBHHs, and I guess another 53 FTEs at Anoka. I see 335 FTEs at the Minnesota Security Hospital. So you're asking for, I guess just among this, something like 760 more FTEs. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the 130 is to maintain the staff complement we already have. So it is saying if we don't have our operating adjustment funded for those 24/7 positions, that we will have to lose a net 130 positions.
Okay, so you'd have 630 more employees then, FTEs. Yep. And I guess, I have a number of questions I guess I could ask, but I guess let me just ask Senator Laurie, Representative Dean, I guess, let me, or others, do you have some questions you'd like to ask the commissioner? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here, and thanks to all of the your staff and also the representatives from the facilities and unions for being here and for sticking around so late. We do appreciate it and apologize for keeping you so late. One of the things that, you know, I think the chairman alluded to when we were looking initially at the budget requests was the inability to operate in the black while fully funded at the requested levels for both the appropriations for bonding 100%, for requested appropriation for 13 100%, for requested appropriation for 15 100%, for requested appropriation for deficiency 100%. And yet here we are with over 600 employees requested just to stay at status quo. It kind of suggests a volatility in long-term projected needs that we need to get our hands around. I know that you've not been there long and that you're kind of getting your sea legs in terms of management of the department, but also some of these critical areas in crisis that I think it's okay that we all call it that. So what say you about the numbers and where we are and just kind of missing the mark in terms of the required budgetary needs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. You know, I think that there's a couple challenges. First is, last session there was a deficiency that was brought, request that was brought and fully funded. Behind that deficiency, there also were improvements that needed to be made to our facilities and to the way we are operating. And this really is an effort, in addition to the deficiency, the MSOX deficiency and the operating adjustment, this request is to try and operate our health system in a way that we think provides better patient care and provides our staff and our patients a more safe environment. And so in the past, our requests, prior to me being commissioner, but I have the impression reflecting and observing that the requests related to continued funding of the way we are operating things now. And these requests try and solve some of the systemic challenges we have by providing additional funding and being more proactive to running our hospitals, our health system, our security hospital in the way that we think it needs to be run if we want to stop having these issues of mandated overtime, really high levels of mandated overtime, if we want to stop these issues of our employees being injured because they're in unsafe work environments, if we want to stop the issues of patients of our hospitals not even meeting the basic level of care needed to be provided to the people that we're serving. And so this request in a lot of ways is a different request than those requests in the past, which were in large part requests to continue to operate our state-operated services in the manner in which they had historically been operated. This request is really trying to change that to solve some of the problems that we continue to see with our employee safety, our patient safety, and our patient care that we're trying to provide.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen.
I apologize for interrupting Representative Dean. I just wanted to mention to everybody that I've had distributed a memo that the commissioner prepared for me about a month ago that offers some additional information that might be of some help, some additional information for us, just so everybody knows where that came from. So I apologize.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. And one of the things that Representative Knobloch brought up earlier was the deficiency request, which was funded earlier, for the $10 or $11 million at the Security Hospital. And follow up to that, which was, you know, this was to add direct care and to add folks at the front lines. Subsequent to that, we kind of said, well, how are we doing? What's our head count? What's our overtime? Where are we adding the folks? And was somewhat surprised to find out those dollars were being used to pay back deficiencies elsewhere to try to manage within your budget. We also have, as one of our reforms that we're looking at, a mandate for the agencies to have legislative approval over interagency transfers and interagency agreements to try to get a handle on some of the inter and intra-agency appropriations and transfers that take place to kind of manage the budget as you're trying to do. So how much, if we were to fully fund that, how much of this is actually new and how much of this has actually already been spent into other buckets that will need to be paid back? Do you have a handle on that, Commissioner?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. 100% of this funding would go to direct care and treatment. And we do have positions that are currently unfunded that are vacant, and I think Ms. Kutza can speak with more specificity to those, but they are within direct care and treatment. And so it's my understanding that during the last biennium, when there was the $10.8 million deficiency request, that behind that was an additional about $12 million worth of deficiency within direct care and treatment that was then there was, for lack of a better term, austerity imposed across the agency to try and manage internally the rest of that deficiency, but that it was a direct care and treatment deficiency, driven deficiency during the last biennium as well.
Thank you.
Well, Commissioner, if I can kind of jump in on that. So with the $10.8 million deficiency funding that we gave you last year, how many more FTEs did you hire with that?
Mr. Chairman, the deficiency funding we received last year was to fill the hole in the MSH budget. So we didn't hire new staff. We paid for the staff that we already had. And it was to address the licensing issues at the time. And the ongoing funding that was appropriated into this biennium, the $11 or $12 million ongoing, was also to fund licensing staff. Some of that staff was new and some of that staff was already hired, but the deficiency was an existing deficiency and didn't fund any new FTEs.
Okay, but then I guess I recall that a portion of it was for some licensing issues, but then I guess as to the cause of the deficiency in the first place, it was partly, I think, caused by the fact that you didn't have enough employees and a lot of people were forced to work overtime. So it was really primarily overtime payments. Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it was primarily, but that is correct. We did not have enough staffing, and it did fund. We had a significant amount of overtime. We still have overtime at that facility, and it was used to fund that as well as the FTEs needed to address the licensing issues.
Okay, so now that you got that deficiency funding and You were given the funding, I think, that you were requested last year. How many more people have you hired in the last year at the Minnesota Security Hospital?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I was just checking with... Mr. Chairman, I understand from the executive director of that facility, 48 to 50 FTEs, new hired.
So you've hired 48 to 50 FTEs, but you want another, was it 335?
336, I believe.
All right. All right, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, just to kind of get at the MSOX money for that, it says that the proposal would replenish mental health fiscal year 17 funds used to support MSOX during 16. So does that mean that we're using 17 money right now, currently?
Correct. When I became, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. When I became commissioner, there had already been a carry back from the next fiscal year into this fiscal year to allow the program to continue operating. Now, the transfer had been, I think the original transfer was $7 million back from FY17 into FY16.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't want to take up any more time for other members to ask questions of the commissioner, but I just want to highlight the importance of the integrated nature of this problem between the state-operated facilities, our private hospitals, the community support systems that we have is really broken. It's within deinstitutionalization as a policy for the state is creating lots of issues and backups and problems. We also have court judgments that are creating new ways that we have to deal with patients, and we're also having a lot more pressure on the system with corrections, and there's people really getting squeezed within that, within those three major policy shifts. That really requires policy change and a lot more common sense, I think, in how we're delivering the care. And the number of FTEs requested in a non-budget appropriation, I think, is kind of staggering. But we're trying to get our head around what these needs actually are. So I think just for members and for people in the public to really understand that this is a big policy change and a change in direction for Minnesota over time. But also, just from a priority standpoint, there's people who are being cared for in the community, in homes by and large, and under waivered services that also have a great deal of need within the Best Life Alliance and 5% Club, that people with profound and complex medical needs being cared for at home that need additional care that aren't getting it. The people that are there are getting having to do overtime, or people are just doing without care. The governor doesn't provide any additional funds for that, and there's no additional funds in the Senate. We believe that the gap there is probably larger than in our state facilities, and is something that I think members should really understand is there and will continue to be there down the road.
I do have some other questions for the commissioner on some other topics, but before we move off of the direct care area, does anyone have any other questions on the direct care area? All right, Commissioner, just as long as you're here, I wanted to ask about two other issues that are separate from this that were in the governor's budget proposal. One is there was this appropriation of about $18 million in 16-17 for what I understand was a 2.72% increase in reimbursement due to some sort of U.S. Department of Labor ruling. Can you talk about that? I mean, I guess, is that a final ruling? Is that a judge somewhere has made this, or is this a final determination by the U.S. Department of Labor? Can you talk about the justification for that and how that money would be spent?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This really reflects a rule that was, I believe, final in 2013 with the U.S. Department of Labor, which required that all home care workers be paid overtime for over 40 hours worked in a week. And so this provides funding for to accommodate a rate increase for certain services to be applied to that rule.
Well, Commissioner, if this happened in 2013, have private providers been doing this and we just haven't been reimbursing them as much, or have we been in violation of the law the last 3 years?
It's my understanding that it hasn't been fully implemented yet by the federal government, and so we're not currently deficient, but that it will be operationalized effective no later, I think, than January 1st, 2017.
And does the governor's recommendation then increase that as of January 2017?
It's July 1, 2016, Mr. Chair. And I would say part of the delay, I believe, was that the final rule went through an appeals process after it became finalized with the Department of Labor.
And has that appeals process been completed?
It's my understanding that yes, Mr. Chair, it has been.
All right. And then I guess the other question I had, let's see. I wanted to go to the whole 5% MA rate increase for preventative medical and dental care and outpatient mental health. I know the governor, the Senate did some of this. The governor had a somewhat higher proposal. Can you talk about the proposed rate increase and the justification for that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These rate increases would be effective July 1, and we feel are very important to make sure that we are paying a fair rate for those services being provided. And so the governor prioritized these particular rates in his budget because of the need specific to these two areas to provide rate increases to providers all across the state.
Okay. Well, I know the hour is growing late, but I guess I want to, as long as the commissioner's here, certainly afford the opportunity for people to ask any other questions they want to ask of her. Senator Cohen.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, if we do nothing this year, and that's not... I'm hoping, I mean, we've been working pretty hard at doing something, so you know, my goal is certainly to do something, but I don't think it's a secret to anybody in this room that, you know, there's some differences between the House and the Senate, you know, we've seen a forecast that's gone down a little bit. So this is, I hope, more of a hypothetical than anything else. If we do nothing this year, and that assumes then we don't do a bonding bill, transportation, or anything else, what are the layoffs within the agency? When are the layoffs made? And what ability is there to shift other existing resources to protect against layoffs?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, I believe you just distributed the memo that I laid out for you around contingency preparation. We would, if we did not receive any funding from the legislature this year to solve for some of these really critical challenges, we would be it would be a very difficult situation. We have a legal obligation to provide these essential services to these very, very vulnerable people, people committed to me by the courts to provide care and treatment to them. If we don't receive funding, I think as this memo lays out, we would be forced to eliminate over 400 positions across the agency, and we believe there would be a direct impact on at least 1,500 people that we serve. And Additionally, I am, as commissioner, not when I'm making these decisions, I am going to be focused on providing the best care possible to the patients that we can provide care to and making sure that it's done in a safe environment. And that includes reducing patient censuses and to assure that I don't have staff being placed in unsafe positions or patients being placed in unsafe positions because staff are being required to continue to work in the way that we have required them to work for because of budget pressures, including at Anoka Hospital, nurses working 16-hour shifts on Christmas Day. It's just that is not going to be part of the plan to reduce the footprint of human services should we not receive any additional funding.
Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, again, I'm asking the hypothetical and just to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem. If we focus on those roughly 400 layoffs and any ancillary services that go with that, what is that approximate ballpark cost?
Commissioner.
I'm sorry, I'm Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, I'm not understanding the question.
What's the cost of the layoffs? How much would it take to prevent the layoffs? I'm sorry, I misstated my question.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, at least $43 million. However, the way we are providing services in hospitals like Anoka, when I became commissioner, we would likely, should we only receive $43 million, reduce further the census at Anoka Hospital to ensure that we have adequate staffing and good patient care for the patients there in the way that we want that treatment to be provided. So, short answer, at least $43 million.
Commissioner, let me look at the other side of it now, and that is, I guess, how many, if we did your full request, how many additional beds would you have for patients that you do not have now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would have a competency restoration program building that would house 32 patients in a new facility. The 16 patients that are currently at that facility would go to a hospital that we would close. So we have a net 32 beds in that competency restoration facility. It would free up about 20 beds at Anoka Hospital for patients coming from other hospitals across the state. And then also if we staffed up each of the six remaining community behavioral health hospitals, those 16-bed hospitals, up to 16 beds, that even with the closure of one of the hospitals is a net gain of an additional 12 beds into our system. So it doesn't drastically increase our footprint, but it adds the 32, the 20 at Anoka, and the 12 beds in our community behavioral health hospitals.
So that's 64 beds. I guess my question is, I know that with the advent of the 48-hour rule, there have been just tremendous new pressures put on the system that weren't there before. And I guess, you know, do you think 64 beds are enough? Or how many beds do you think we really need in this state, given the new realities of the 48-hour rule?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have actually been working really closely with the Minnesota Hospital Association to understand more from them across health systems in private hospitals, how many people need access to inpatient mental health services that aren't receiving sufficient access all across the state. And the Hospital Association is compiling those numbers right now, which I think will provide us a good indication of, at this moment in time, how many people are waiting for mental health beds that they can't have access to now. We do know at Anoka we currently have a wait list of about 50 people waiting to get into Anoka at any given time. So we know right now at least 50 people are waiting for those Anoka beds that don't have access to them. One thing that the governor has committed to going forward in 2016 is the work of a mental health task force, which he created a few weeks ago by executive order. And that task force really is it's my hope, a table where we bring our partners in community mental health and inpatient mental health in the hospitals, in corrections, with sheriffs running county jails, with the courts, around the same table at this task force to identify systemically across the entire continuum of care and mental health in Minnesota, where are the gaps currently? Because what this package is really focused and targeted on our safety net. So that really acute, the most acute, most expensive end of the continuum of care for people with mental illness, living with mental illness in the state of Minnesota. And we do need to have that comprehensive analysis of where else are the gaps in the continuum. So I don't have an answer tonight about a magic number or where the gaps are. I think that that work is best done with all of the stakeholders managing mental health issues across the state at the table.
And Commissioner, that's 64, I'm sorry, Senator Lori.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay, so the 64 beds you mentioned, if the governor's proposal was fully funded, does that include the full funding of his bonding proposal too, or are you just talking about the operating proposal that's in front of us, getting you 64 beds?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The governor's bonding proposals for Security Hospital in Anoka don't add beds. And so this is really talking about 64 beds being added through budget requests. The bonding proposals solve for the problems at Security Hospital with the facilities themselves, but it doesn't expand in any great way the footprint of Security Hospital. Additionally, the bonding proposals in the governor's bonding bill for Anoka relate to improved security at the facility, so a man-down system for the staff, glass around more nurses' stations, courtyards extending out in each of the units for the ability for patients to have access to the outdoors in all of the six units at that hospital. So the bonding, that's a long way of saying, the bonding proposal doesn't add beds. This adds beds.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This, you know, one of the things that we have been focused on a lot tonight is really one end of the continuum of care, trying to fix a much broader mental health problem, set of problems across all of our communities. You know, last year, Representative Dean and I worked, you know, pretty hard, and we really did focus on the community-based side and really trying to support people where they live and prevent the crises that result in a need for inpatient care. And that just needs to be called out, that there really is a need to have that conversation over the interim. I will serve on that task force. And we'll come back and we'll take a look at this, but we aren't going to fix the whole mental health problem just by building beds. So, I mean, we're really, I think what the governor brought forward and what the Senate really tried to accomplish was, you know, stabilizing our system, trying to help people move through the system in a better way, be in the right setting at the right time to the greatest extent possible. But still recognizing there's a long way to go to make sure that people, you know, quite frankly, really avoid the crises. I mean, we'll never build enough beds to get ourselves out of this system, out of this set of problems that we have. And so this year, I think we are really at a breaking point, and we really do need to take stock of how direct care and treatment is working and put in those, you know, measures that can really stabilize our existing safety net end of the continuum of care, and then continue this conversation and come back and continue to try to improve the whole mental health system. It's not something that's going to be fixed in 1 year, and it's not going to be fixed with what we have before us. I mean, it's a much bigger problem, and this is one set of the continuum of care that people need.
Other discussion or questions for the commissioner?
Call the chair. Make sense?
Okay, let me recognize Senator Cohen to talk about our plans for tomorrow.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You and I have had some discussions this evening.
Well, excuse me. Let me first go ahead and say thank you to the commissioner and the CFO. Thanks for your testimony, and we'll then turn it over to Senator Cohen.
Thank you.
So, and my thanks to the commissioner and staff as well. Mr. Chairman, you and I have had some discussions earlier this evening about how we'd like to proceed, and tomorrow the meeting will be call of the chair, although likely not to be a meeting. And Mr. Chairman, that will give us an opportunity to work with our respective conferees and other chairs and work in terms of where we are procedurally over the next couple of days. And so you and I will have a chance to spend some time, and we want to spend some time with each of our respective conferees and, again, the additional committee and division chairs who are not conferees. Is that a fair comment as to our...
Yep, that makes sense to me. So, questions, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, do we have a roadmap, just not only for us, but maybe for the audience as far as the few days ahead? I was just curious, on Friday, Saturday, God forbid Sunday. What are the thoughts there?
Well, I suppose it, to some extent, depends on who has the call. I guess I certainly, given the amount of material we have before us, would not guarantee that we wouldn't meet one day this weekend, but I certainly would personally hope that we would not meet two. I don't know, Senator Cohen?
Yeah, I'm sure we're not going to meet 2 days this weekend. We'll see what happens the next couple days, and that's part of the purpose of trying to work with, again, a respective group, Senate and House, tomorrow, and talk about a Representative McNamara, as you suggest, a roadmap as to what happens the next couple of days.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you to both of you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, everyone. Good night. Meeting adjourned.